We'll call the Minsher Legislative Oversight Committee together, and we'll go in order of the agenda here, except that I do have a couple of updates on the agenda. On item four, as we're working with the Minsher Board of Directors and the update, Executive Director Leitz is going to be presenting two, and it probably makes more sense to do the Deloitte report along with that as a whole package, and so we'll have those questions at that time. And then when we move to the Shattuck report, we can just focus on the Shattuck report and be done with that Minsher presentation portion. And then at the end of the agenda, before we adjourn, I know that issues have been circulating regarding the 16,000 pending cases and the 3,000 individuals on Minnesota Care that may have been charged the wrong premium, that are issues that are working around. And so we're going to ask DHS to come up and present on how that occurred, why that occurred, what's being done to rectify that, and give us an update on that as well. I know that that's been a matter of some concern as well, and wanted to make sure that we had some time to cover those issues as well. So with that, do we do an official roll call? I don't think so. I mean, we see who's there. So we have minutes from the April 9th meeting. They've been sitting in front of members for a little while. Any additions or corrections to the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Senator Chair, Spencer. The minutes do not reflect a vote that we took on my motion.
Did we take a vote on your motion?
No, we did not take a vote on my motion.
And so what should the minutes say?
We could amend the minutes to say Chair Atkins adjourned the committee without voting on the Benson motion.
Well, I mean, I think that adjourning is, you know, I mean, I think adjourning says that there wasn't a vote taken. I think that does seem a little redundant, but I do get your point. Do you have a...
Mr. Chair, I note that there is in capital and underlined for your motion a resolution to your motion, and there is no resolution to my motion except adjournment.
Okay, I mean, there was a vote taken on that motion. There wasn't a vote taken. I mean, we could say there was discussion about the potential to make a recommendation to the legislature, but no vote was taken. Is that?
That's accurate.
Yeah. What is accurate, Mr. Chair, is that the meeting was adjourned in the middle of that discussion. That's what's accurate. So I'd like the minutes to reflect that the meeting was adjourned without a vote on Benson's motion.
Well, if you really want what's accurate, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you. Is that there was a motion made that was with respect to an item that was not on the agenda at the time. So it wasn't properly before us. I still managed to give you an opportunity to make the motion. But we did not, you're correct in that we did not take a vote on it. We did place it on the agenda for this meeting. You're obviously welcome to, may choose to do what you want to do, but I look forward to a good discussion about releasing the rates.
So with that, let's amend the minutes to include a statement that a discussion about the possibility of recommending to the legislature early release of rates was undertaken, but no vote was had. And with that, any other additions or corrections to the minutes?
I think just the Mr. Chairman and Mr. Brickwitty's name has two D's in it.
And then correct the spelling of Mr. Brickwitty's name at the Department of Commerce. Sorry about that, Peter. Any other additions, corrections? Seeing none. Senator Sharon moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. And with that, we'll jump right in to an update from the Minture Board of Directors. We'll ask Mr. Buettner and Chair Buettner and maybe CEO Lights to come join us. Welcome to the committee. State your names for the record.
Housekeeping. I just don't want to sit on your lap. Thank you. I'm Brian Buettner. I'm chair of the board of Minture, and I appreciate you having me here today and your continued attention to Minture. I'll try to make my remarks brief and then turn it over to Scott and the Minture team to provide specific information about the progress of Minture. You may recall the very first time that I came before you was exactly 1 year ago today, and I concluded my comments that day with the note that Minnesota was the only state in the country where all relevant groups supported the formation of the state-based exchange, from the governor to the regulatory agencies to the legislature, health plans, social service community, the broker community, providers, just to name a few. We've seen the benefits of that collaboration over the last year. They've all stepped up, spent their organization's time, human efforts, and money to achieve in the first 6 months a major impact on a problem that is 60 years in the making. This is a good first step. I'm proud that through Minture, over 250,000 Minnesotans have better, more affordable health care coverage than they've ever had. I'm proud that Minnesota offers the lowest premium rates in the country, whether you buy through Minture or not. I'm proud that Minnesota has reduced its uninsured rates to historically low levels. And I'm proud of what all Minnesotans have done to make this happen. The approach that Minnesota took in creating this state-based exchange is unique. This is because Minnesota is unique in providing Minnesota care to our citizens. This provides yet another opportunity for people to obtain affordable, comprehensive health care insurance in addition to medical assistance and QHPs, whether subsidized by the federal advanced premium tax credits or not. While a great benefit to our state and significantly contributing to the record drop in uninsured rates, it has added complexity to our world. Minsure does much more than the federal exchange. The federal exchange only provides access to private insurance plans. The majority of Minsure customers, well over 200,000 people, have obtained coverage through medical assistance and Minnesota Care. The state has chosen to use the ACA and the existence of federal grants to help solve state issues around the delivery of social services, of which health care is the largest. The platform of Minsure is an opportunity to greatly improve what we can do for all of our citizens. As with any startup opportunity, we will have growing pains. Our growing pains have been and will continue to be the subject of news coverage and public debate. I believe that's a good thing. That's how Minsure will continue to improve. The Minsure Board is committed to soliciting feedback from consumers and stakeholders. Minsure Board has met 32 formal public meetings since we last met, or we first met a year ago. And each board member has probably had hundreds of phone calls, meetings with staff, citizens, stakeholders, and others to ensure that this opportunity is well guided. The oversight that the Minsure Board has provided has set the direction of Minsure to be transparent, accountable, consumer-focused, fiscally responsible, and proactive when needed. At the height of Minsure's struggles, the board stepped up and filled the void to set direction and establish a top-notch management team to execute on that vision. Since then, we've continued to do what any good consumer-oriented business would do. Our experience in running our respective businesses told us to step back and evaluate. This started with the end-to-end review by Optum in January, and that identified items to address in both the near term, the midterm, and the long term. In the near term, we needed to help consumers directly. Open enrollment was still going on. We immediately improved the call center, and staff has developed a flexible plan to deal with the volume spikes that Minsure will be sure to see during open enrollment this fall and as renewals come up. In the midterm, we established a project management structure for the IT system development. In addition to bringing in a nationally recognized firm of Deloitte to get this started, Minute has stepped up to be the project director, and we've already seen the benefits of this in recent software releases, upgrading the performance of the current IT system. And over the long term, we've asked Deloitte to help spend a couple of things with us. In their first 60 days of their work, they're helping us prepare for fall open enrollment as well as the long term. Their series of deliverables has provided a very detailed gap analysis, a list of what works and what doesn't. That enables Minsure staff to identify the steps to improve, the priority in which items must be accomplished, and work plan to achieve these goals. As a board, we're committed to making improvements for the fall, as well as developing a long-term plan for continued success. We will deliver improved functionality for the fall. We will establish a long-term design for the technology platform, and we'll reach out to the other half of the uninsured who did not sign up last fall. The board will continue to lead, push, and assist to accomplish our number one goal of getting all Minnesotans the security of access to affordable, comprehensive health care insurance. A few final comments before I turn it to Scott. One of the things that we do as a board, and I do almost daily, I think, with Scott and his team, is to help make sure that everybody keeps their eye focused on the prize. And the prize is not this week, next week, or even a month from now. We're building better lives for hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. These are real people with real improvements that have come because all stakeholders across Minnesota, the health plans, the care providers, the state agencies, especially DHS, navigators, brokers, hundreds of community organizations have all worked above and beyond to help create a fully functioning public market for health care insurance. This work is a testament to what Minnesotans can do working together. That cooperation and collaboration has already delivered real results for Minnesotans. A historically low uninsured rate, the lowest rates, premium rates in the country, and I appreciate the patience and the persistence of all these stakeholders, including this committee and your colleagues, to continue to improve healthcare access coverage in this state. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Buettner. Mr. Leitz?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the CEO at Minsure. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to discuss the progress that we're making on Minsure. As of today, as Chair Buettner mentioned, we've enrolled more than a quarter million people in affordable comprehensive health coverage through Minsure. And as we'll talk about a little bit later in this meeting, the result of that and efforts that have also been occurring elsewhere means that Minnesota has an uninsurance rate that is the lowest in state's history and the second lowest in the country. We've, as of today, enrolled over 266,000 persons in health coverage through Minsure. That said, we're very aware and keenly aware of the improvements that we need to make to the system ahead of the open enrollment period, which starts November 15th. We have a number of top priorities that we need to accomplish moving into that open enrollment period, including functionality to ensure that people who are currently enrolled through Minsure are able to do renewals. Remember, this open enrollment period will differ from last year's open enrollment period in the sense that new people will be coming through as they did last year, but renewing people will also be coming through, and that's something we need to have an ability to do. But we remain focused on improving the customer experience for the fall. I want to, if I can, take members back to January. That was when we took a step to bring in Optum to conduct an end-to-end review of our system, of the Minsure system. It had not performed well in the fall. I don't think that's news to anyone around this particular table. And we felt it was important to bring in a trusted outside entity to have a look at the system and give us some recommendations. They brought back a number of recommendations in a number of areas, including how to improve some of the service in our contact center, the program technical management, as well as the software and underlying data systems. We acted swiftly on those recommendations, and it gave us a very nice overall framework to work from. We put in place, reinstated some program governance structure. We added additional capacity in the call center that ultimately reduced wait times from 60 minutes in December to around 60 seconds in the month of March. And we began to improve the IT experience. We didn't fix the IT experience, and quite honestly, the IT experience still is not fixed. But it's markedly better than it was, and we continue to make those improvements. And I'll touch on a number of areas on how we intend to do that in a moment. And we started the process of bringing on a key recommendation from the Optum report, which was that the project truly needed a general contractor, someone to oversee the overall work of the project and ensure that the vendors, state staff, and state agencies were working closely together to ensure that we delivered on the project. When I took this role back in December, I made a commitment to this committee and to the public that we would be a transparent organization and that we would provide information about what was working in the system and what was not working in the system, and we would do so in an open manner. We've tried to do that and strive to do that, and we're committed to continuing that process. I think the work that Deloitte, the contractor that we did bring on to help us do that general contracting, and the work that they're bringing forth is I think our goal is to make sure that that information not only guides what we're doing and the improvements that we're making, but is also available to the public so that they understand the process that we're going through and the progress that we're making as well. We asked Deloitte to look at a number of areas. We are in the process, and I'll touch on those in a moment. We are in the process of wrapping up the assessment phase with Deloitte, and we're headed steadfastly into the work plan of the implementation. This really does begin and continue our path forward to make us make the substantial investments that we need to ahead of open enrollment. I want to make sure members understand that there, in some sense, are two tracks here. There's a legacy system that was there in the fall. That system didn't function well in the fall. We made improvements to that system. It functioned better through the spring. Anyone who used it in the spring would also tell you there were still additional improvements that could be made and should be made, and we're continuing to make improvements to that underlying system as we move into fall open enrollment. Fortunately, Deloitte has indicated to us that that underlying system is strong. It has a good chassis. It needs improvements, but it has the right horsepower to be able to carry us through open enrollment. There's a second piece that Deloitte has helped us with, which is to really identify what additional pieces do we need to add to the system, what new functionalities do we need that were not there in the fall to make the consumer experience and the enrollment experience and the overall experience of coming in through MNsure better. So Deloitte's work has really been separated into five distinct deliverables. These include contract reconciliation, taking a look at the contracts that were originally let, taking a look at what work has been has occurred under those, what work needs to continue to occur under the original contracts, a governance assessment and recommendations in those areas. When I say governance, I'm talking about the IT project itself. Mr. Chair, I know it can get confused sometimes. I'm not talking about the overall governance and the board, really just about how the IT project itself is governed and making sure that we have clear and defined roles and functions. A functional and technical assessment. Another way of saying this, it's a gaps analysis. Taking a look at the system we have and bringing back findings, quite honestly, around what should a well-functioning system have, what do you currently have, and what are the steps you should take to do that. A work plan to be able to move us forward to fill those gaps, help prioritize where we're at, and ensure that we're able to add critical functionalities in advance of the fall open enrollment period. And I think it's clear that there's a lot of hard work ahead. I don't think anybody who's been following this either directly through the reports that have been coming out or through the media would be surprised to learn that there are a lot of improvements that are still to be made to the system. The system itself, as I said, is functioning much better than it had been. That said, the system itself can certainly has a lot of room for improvement, and that's what we're working very hard with Deloitte on right now. They worked us through a process with state staff and with our vendors around identifying some very key high-level priorities for us to accomplish. We've identified 30 things that we believe need to occur for the fall open enrollment period. We're going through right now the last deliverable that Deloitte will have, or the next deliverable, I should say, will be a really a work plan around how do we deliver on those 30 key priorities, some of which will be automated, some of which, quite honestly, if they can't be automated, we are committed to finding ways to ensure that we have plans in place. That would be a distinction from last fall when the system didn't function well. There really weren't plans in place to deal with some of the challenges that we had. I think we learned a lesson from that as an organization, and this year are very committed to ensuring that we have plans in place, even if we aren't able to have perfect functionality. Pivoting away just for a moment from the issue of the system, there's a parallel track that we're working on right now, which is really around ensuring that as we move into fall open enrollment, we have in place a very good system of collaborators, of people working with us, of partners, to ensure that people are aware of their options on health insurance coverage, that they have the assistance that they need to get into coverage, and that we're meeting them where they're at. I think one of the things we discovered during fall open enrollment, and I can tell you this was a learning from every single state, as well as at the federal level, people needed a lot of assistance in getting enrolled, regardless of whether they're enrolling in Medicaid, in Minnesota Care, or in a commercial plan. There simply was a high-level assistance that was necessary. And so we're looking at that. We're about to put out a series of outreach grants that will be targeted at ensuring that people have that assistance that they need. They're in sort of the final phase. We should anticipate being able to announce those grants in the early fall so that there's plenty of time for people to be able to be on the ground working in advance of fall open enrollment. I should mention that the RFP for those grants was guided very heavily by what we learned from A, last year's process, but B, the data that we've been able to collect from the state of Minnesota's state health department's surveys, as well as other work that's been done. We really wanted to tap into that. Another area that we worked very hard on and has been a very high priority of mine since coming to the organization has been to ensure that we have very strong relationships, or at least improved relationships, with the broker agent community, the navigator community, community services, and others. We've added two positions specifically, one a navigator liaison position, another a broker agent liaison position, which we were very fortunate to be able to hire from within that community for a person to play that role, a very well-respected individual who is in both of those positions really serves as a point of contact for our key partners in this to ensure that they're able to get the information that they need, help to resolve issues as they arise, as well as get them information so that we're on a level playing field. There's a lot of important work that's going to be ahead here as we head into fall open enrollment, and our success as an organization and collectively can only be accomplished without the very good partnership of those key partners. One other group I want to mention who has been a key partner throughout this process over the course of the past several years has been the health plans and the work that they've done. Collectively, it has been a large effort. They've put in a lot of hours. Chair Buettner mentioned the work that's been done across many stakeholder groups, none more than the health plans. They've really stepped up and really been a terrific partner working with us as we've developed processes that, frankly, none of us anticipated needing to develop. And have been very creative and very, I think, patient and very excellent partners. And we're looking forward to working with them as we move into the fall open enrollment period. On outreach, the final thing I'll mention, Mr. Chair, is that despite the fact that we're not in an open enrollment period, that doesn't mean that we're not continuing to do outreach throughout the course of the summer. We are appearing throughout the state. We'll be at Farm Fest. We'll be at Rondo Days. We have National Night Out. We'll be at the State Fair. We're hitting every community as best we can and trying to meet whatever needs people have to keep the word out that coverage is still available during this period for folks who are enrolling in a public health insurance program, but also to make them aware of their options heading into the fall. I'll close, Mr. Chair, by saying a couple of things. The first is that we're very squarely focused right now on making the necessary improvements we need to make the fall open enrollment period a much better one for Minnesotans than it was last year. We think that the processes are in place for us to be able to do that. We worked very diligently with Deloitte to identify where our gaps are and to prioritize those gaps so that we're able to bring a much better functioning system to Minnesotans by fall. And it's really our goal to be able to do that. We were heartened by the data that came in about the uninsured being reduced so dramatically, but we also know that there's a lot of work ahead. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll close and thank you for your time, and I'm very happy to answer any questions that members might have.
Tell us a little bit. So you have this contract with Deloitte, but we still have the existing contracts with the vendors who did the build-out of last year's system. And I know those were scheduled to expire in June, I believe. And do we have the contract structure that we need to carry us through open enrollment and the plan to have all of this work done? Is that something that's...
Mr. Chair, you're correct that the contracts with the vendors were originally scheduled, just to remind members, were going to expire on March 31st. We extended those contracts to June 30th to ensure that we were able to move through open enrollment period and have some time to then step back and renegotiate the contracts with the vendors. We used that interim period to do just that, which is to work with the contractors, remind them of the deliverables. I think the work that Deloitte did around the contract reconciliation really fed into that analysis so that we were able to work with an outside vendor having some neutral information, bring that back to us around what had been delivered under the contracts, what had not been delivered under the contracts. So as we restructured the contracts moving forward, we were able to do that with those findings in mind. We have reached agreement with all the vendors. The only vendor that we're still finalizing the agreement with, and quite honestly, the reason that we haven't yet finalized the agreement with, this is IBM that I'm talking about, is simply because they actually were the ones we were probably furthest along with actually having closure on. So we concentrated our time on the other contracts. We anticipate closure with IBM this week. They've been very cooperative and collaborative in getting to a finality. So by the end of this week or in the very near future, we'll have full closure on all the contracts. Suffice to say, there's just the one left that we don't have closure on right now.
And then that the renegotiated contracts still work within the existing budget framework that you've presented to us in the past. We're in good shape on delivering a better experience this fall than last fall with the budget framework that has been established.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we are still working within the budget that was submitted to the legislature in March, and are still living within those means and intend to do so.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Leitz, I did have a budget question, so this leads nicely into it. Deloitte recommended that there be planned manual procedures for open enrollment this fall, and there's been quite a lot of manual work around. Has the budget been updated to reflect those operational realities, and where's that money coming from? Is DHS sort of eating the staff time that's been spent to do the manual enrollments, and what's the plan for paying that staff going forward should we need manual enrollments this fall?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, thinking back to the budget that was submitted to the legislature for your review back in March, I believe it was, there was a line that we put in there. We anticipated that while we could anticipate certain things, there were certain things that we knew were going to come up that we just couldn't at that point in time anticipate. I think this is one of those. And the way that we dealt with that within that budget was actually to set aside an unallocated amount of money. I believe it was $5 or $6 million to be able to deal with issues as they arose. Some of that we anticipate will be additional system costs that there may be something that we can add that we weren't anticipating at the time. But also some of it would be things like manual processes where we would have to, for example, pay additional resources either for staff or to an outside vendor to assist with some of the manual pieces. So that's sort of how we budgeted for it. And so it comes really, I think, if I was to sort of line item it anywhere, it probably would have fallen in that line.
And, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, what are we at for total federal grant money beginning to end, appropriated, drawn, everything right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I'll do my best, but we may need to follow up more specifically. And I'll look to Wes if he's still in the room to say, okay, I'll do my best. We'll need to follow up more specifically. My understanding is that we've been allocated around $150 or so odd million in federal grants. We anticipate that at the end of the year, we will have some chunk of that will be unspent, probably somewhere around $5 or $6 million. And I think we're anticipating, if I remember correctly from the budget that we submitted to the legislature, an ongoing budget of $40 or so million on an ongoing basis that'll need to be covered through the assessment moving forward. I know you were asking more about the federal piece. So we'll happily follow up with members with that information after the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Senator Benson?
And Mr. Leitz, I'm just concerned how we're going to, I know the vendors that were previously contracted are just having to work until their mistakes are fixed, but now we've added Deloitte to the mix. I know Optum did the work pro bono. So going forward, I'd like to have a little more detailed understanding, and we can get that after this meeting, but where the money's going, because I thought it was all spent, and now we're doing more spending, and yet I'm being told the budget is staying the same, and so I'm just going to need to tighten down on that. So if we can get more detail following up to this meeting, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we'd be very happy to do that, and I just want to be very clear that I think in the budget that you saw, dollars balanced, but that was really with the clear intent, I think, that we had to make sure that we had left a little money on the bottom line to be able to deal with some unexpected things that come up. But I understand your question. We'll be happy to follow up with it.
Mr. Lights, that probably would be helpful. I mean, now that we've restructured the contracts, I mean, I guess I didn't have the same take. I did think that from my last view of the budget and what was presented, I thought that it did have sufficient room to rework it. But we should see it reworked with the new agreements that we have with the vendors. So if you could follow up with the committee, that'd be helpful. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lights, I know you'd be disappointed if I didn't ask, because I ask at every meeting. You talked about the number of 266,000 enrolled, and this is the part I always ask. Do we know yet, or is there a way to know what percentage of those folks were uninsured previously?
Mr. Lights?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, I'll sleep well tonight knowing that you did cross your T and dot your I's. Thank you. You know, I think let me step back for just a second in answering your question. We've, I think, understood the broader policy question that's being asked here, and that was part of the reason that we engaged the University of Minnesota to do the study, and I know they're going to talk later, so I won't go into their details. And I also understand that the questions that they looked at, which were important ones, don't specifically get at the one I know that you're asking, which is of the people who've come through, what proportion of the people who've enrolled through MNsure, for example? And the short answer is we don't have a specific answer to that question. So I'm willing to say that. I think that one of the things that we have been balancing out is do we collect information as part of the enrollment process around whether people have coverage or as they're coming in or don't they? And I think I've testified before this committee that we do collect some of that information. It turns out, as I've come to have a better understanding, that we collect it in certain cases, but not in all cases. So it would be at best a snapshot of a small subset. I don't think we have, as an organization, any particular concerns about collecting that particular information. It's something we should look at moving forward. It's a balance between, I think, collecting the amount of information that we need to minimally make sure people are enrolled without collecting more information than we need about people on from a privacy perspective. So that's I just want to make it clear that I don't think we oppose doing that. It's just a matter of that balance. And I think we'd love to get some guidance from you all around how important you think that issue is. And I think we'll do that. The second thing I would say is that one thing that we do know from work that the State Health Department's been doing over the course of the last 10 years is that most of the people who are uninsured in Minnesota, because of our historically rather generous standards around public program eligibility, most of those people are eligible for a public health insurance program. So about two-thirds of the people who are uninsured are eligible for either Medicaid or Minnesota care, and about 82% of kids. So when we've seen the numbers that we've seen around enrollment in Medicaid and Minnesota care that have occurred during the open enrollment period, I think it perhaps wasn't overly surprising that we did see a reduction in the uninsurance rate. And I think it's fair to say largely that was driven by that public program enrollment. And so while we don't have a specific answer to the question that you're asking, and we'll continue to look at how we can continue to try to not have you have to answer that, ask that each time, I do think that some of the data that SHADAC brought forth and the university brought forth starts to give us some indication that we're covering some people who wouldn't otherwise have been covered.
Well, and, you know, maybe when we have the folks from the U up, too, we could ask for advice about how to scope that question. I mean, that is actually a very complex question to ask. And even collecting voluntary information provided during an insurance application is maybe not even the best scoping of how to get at that. I mean, I think historically we've used a survey after the fact and really extrapolated from that to determine how and where people get their insurance and things. So we can maybe get some advice about how to best scope that. And I would assume that MNsure has worked on some of that. But you had a follow-up, and then I know Representative Atkins and Huntley also had questions. Representative Hoppe.
Actually, I had just one comment. Thank you for that, because I think unless we know how many people are insured now that didn't have it before, I don't know how we ever measure whether or not we're being successful. And then I had a question about outreach grants. Should I wait for a minute and let others have their turn, or do you want me to ask?
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights, you mentioned outreach grants, and there's a new wave of them coming out. How does MNsure know, how do you measure that in terms of if you give 10 different organizations $100,000 each, and they all enroll different numbers of people. Is there any matrix to measure the cost per enrollee or anything like that? Or are you looking at it strictly from if you give 10 grants of 100,000, that's a million on the bottom line, and then you worry about re-enrollment or whatever it would be next year? If you could shed some light on that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, I think it's fair to say that the first round of grants that we did, we did a lot of them. There was 40-some-odd grants that ended up going out. And I think the goal of those grants was to maybe try to let 1,000 flowers bloom and see what worked. And that was probably a very appropriate approach in year one. And we got a little bit of information from that, although I would have to say that the rigor around which that any evaluation of that wasn't as substantial as we want to have it be moving forward. It's not to say that we received reports back from them. We understood what the activities that they were doing, how many people they were enrolling, and so forth. This next round, we've taken a slightly different approach, which was to do fewer grants. There's still going to be a substantial number going out. But to really strive towards ensuring that there's better coordination between the grantees so that we're asking for organizations to really try to, instead of just being a silo or an island, demonstrate how they're going to be working or, frankly, more functionally just work with other organizations so that we're getting good partnerships that are occurring. As part of that, we are going to be asking for additional amounts of information back from them. I think the question that you're asking is a very legitimate one around what are we actually getting for the dollars that we're spending? Are we getting enrollment? Are we getting enrollment in the harder-to-reach areas, which is really an important issue, where certain populations are easier to insure, certain populations traditionally just have higher uninsurance rates? We've used data to try to indicate where those are and then to try to grant in those areas. But I think on the back end of that, we're going to have to do a better job around rigor in ensuring that we're getting information about that. We intend to do that, and I think it's very fair for this committee to be asking us about that and asking for us to report back on what those look like.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick follow-up to that, and I understand that cost isn't everything, and there are a lot of other things that go into that, as you mentioned, and I appreciate that. But is cost per enrollee going to be one of the things that you, one of the criteria? So if, you know, somebody was more efficient with their dollars during the last round of grants, are they going to get more money this time? Or if they were less efficient, you know, they'll get fewer chances or no chance?
Mr. Lights?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, I don't know if that was a factor going into this year because I don't know that we had that specific of information to be able to structure it. Your point's taken, though, and I think that moving forward as we think about how to measure this current round, we'll take that into consideration.
Thank you.
We had Representative Atkins next.
Mine's very quick, Mr. Chairman. While I appreciate everyone's attendance here this morning, I wanted to single out one particular group, and that are the kids here from Bethlehem Children Child Care Center, and everyone in orange for joining us this morning. I knew they were going to be here, and I appreciate their joining us. I hope they're enjoying the tour, albeit a little bit abbreviated since you can't see some of the spaces, but we're glad to have you guys here joining us this morning.
And everyone in orange included Rich Neumeister, even.
That's so right. Nice. And Lucy Morgan. Not you, Lights.
Can I join the Bethlehem? I'd be happy to do that.
You got to be wearing a full-blown T-shirt. So. Thank you for your indulgence.
Yes. Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair and members, just a comment follow-up on Representative Hoppe's questions, and maybe Shattuck will tell us, but if Minnesota has about 5 million people and we've reduced the uninsured rate by 3.3%, that's 165,000 people, yet we've insured 265,000. So the question is, did 100,000 of those, did they already have insurance someplace else? Or are they just renewing MA and so on?
266 is what all those of that have come through Minsure, and many of them already had insurance. To tell you the truth, some of those that probably didn't have insurance probably went through the private marketplace and aren't even in the 266. I mean, they're, you know, we'd need one of those circle graphs, and they all overlap. I don't know, maybe that's in the Shattuck report. We'll have one of those, but yeah, and we can get deeper into that, but they are very complex questions, and I will also echo the thank you for coming, kids, and the staff who
Hope you enjoyed it. Did you find it really interesting, guys?
I was so focused I didn't even know all the kids in orange shirts came in.
Oh. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And back to the outreach grants. Mr. Leitz, do the navigators, the people working at these outreach grant organizations, the organization gets paid for every enrollee? Is that accurate? They get, I thought it was $75.
Mr. Leitz?
Yeah, there's sort of two streams, if you will, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson. One is the outreach grant activities where we grant money to them to be able to have capacity to do the outreach. They also do, there's a per enrollment fee that's paid. It varies depending on the type of enrollment. If it's Minnesota Care or the private market, $75. If it's a Medicaid enrollment, it's $25.
Well, and that's for, so there's navigators, there's also brokers, and those are separate than these outreach grants. So, I mean, you may not have gotten an outreach grant, but you're still eligible to be a navigator or a broker and get paid through those other streams of money on a per enrollee basis. So I think that these outreach grants, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to make sure that we all are straight on this, that the outreach grants are just that, the ability for these organizations to get out there into the communities and do the outreach that they need to be ready to reach these hard to reach communities that, you know, we've struggled for years and years to reach the enrollment goals that we're finally getting at.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Because we've had this reduction in the number of uninsured, I apologize, Mr. Leitz, if I missed this. Is your budget for outreach grants going to be smaller going forward because there's a smaller targeted population? There was quite a big spend, and the return per enrollee wasn't very good for some of these organizations. And so if they failed the first round, I don't know why we'd give them another shot. We have specific targeted needs, and there's no point in giving money to people who didn't accomplish that last time.
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we would agree with that fully. I think that we're trying to do just that, which is to look at the metrics that we have, to not necessarily fund those who weren't as good at performers, but really to fund more of the innovative performers or those who actually did well. Unfortunately, year one wasn't we didn't have as good of metrics as we would have liked to have had it to do that. But I think moving forward, that is our intention very much. So we would agree with that statement.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And if Mr. Leitz could help me out, how much are you going to allocate for outreach grants?
The budget that's being allocated is about $4 million.
Senator Benson, and then, Senator Sharon, you had
Thank
a question?
Thank you. Every time someone speaks, I have another question. Oh. I'm sorry. just to stay with the last series of questions, this $4 million in outreach grants, I just am not clear. If you are a grantee allowed a grant, are you drawing down on your grant by the number of persons that you enroll, or do you have a baseline amount of money that goes to the organization for materials, and then they also can collect or draw down for each person they enroll?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, it's the latter. And as the chair mentioned, the organization's able to tap into the per enrollee payment aren't just the ones that are paid for through the grants. The grants are really to fund organizations where we know that the ability to have some infrastructure, some materials, a presence in the community that needs to be funded through a staff member or so forth will actually increase enrollment. But they're certainly also eligible to get per enrollee payments, but not the only ones eligible to receive that.
Thank you. So the grant is a separate issue, Senator Lurie, from the drawdown for per enrollee. Those are separate dollars. And I hear the discussion about efficiencies and costs per enrollee, but we're talking about now, and we talked about this for years, Senator Lurie talked about this, that we have been trying to, when we take a look at the uninsured in Minnesota, for years we've been talking about that many of them are eligible for public programs. So we've struggled with methodologies and ways to get that group of people covered under the insurance. That's one of the major reasons why the old system was not working and why we needed this reform and why building the public programs into the into this MNsure program is demonstrating itself as finally having something in place, even though we've had technological difficulties to get at this problem of the uninsured who were eligible and could be insured if we were actually able to do what we need to do to draw them into the program. So it's one of the major bragging points for MNsure to be able to say the old system was broken, it was not functioning, and this is a one of the things that's better in the new system. But you are correct. We really distributed these grants in a way that, well, at least many of us thought, did not recognize that the difficult-to-reach population have to be reached in very special ways and that they may not be the traditional well-developed systems that have operating systems that can... They may have to struggle a little bit with this money in order to reach these difficult populations. This is a long, long time problem. So my question is, how have we done better at that? How have we done better at identifying the correct groups of people to do the outreach to those who really are left eligible for these programs but not moving into the system so that it can become... an increased number of people who are now insured. What's different?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, you asked the right question, very much so. And I think that one of the learnings, and I mentioned this in my opening remarks, one of the learnings that we had in the first open enrollment period is that while we've talked about the website, and I've heard it referred to as, sort of the Travelocity for health insurance, choosing insurance coverage is fundamentally more complex than choosing a rental car. And so what we discovered was that while it was a really great, amazing, transparent place for people to get information, they then needed help to sort through that information, at least in these first few years of how to get there from here, how to actually make a choice, what a deductible meant, all of those things, and what the trade-offs were between premium and copay and all of those things. So that was a lesson we learned, and what we also learned during that process is that individuals really leaned on trusted people to help make them make that decision. In some cases, it was family members that they knew. In some cases, they would contact an agent or broker that they knew or trusted. But in many cases, they contacted the people in the community that they knew, that they trusted and knew would give them good advice. That might be through a church. That might be through a community partner that where they go and do their childcare through a community center or so forth. And so as we put out the second round of grant applications, we did so with an eye towards at least two things. One was allowing the data and the information that we had to guide us towards where we knew that there were remaining pockets of the uninsured. Because you're absolutely right. We made a lot of progress this first year. We're very happy with that. But there's still a lot of progress to be made because we still have, while less than 5%, we still have, 4-point-some-odd percent uninsured, and there's work to be done there. But then secondly, underneath that, we looked at those organizations that demonstrated via the RFP process a real solid understanding and a real solid plan for how to actually go about reaching those populations. And that was part of the review process that we had as part of those RFPs. So I guess I would answer your question by saying we learned some lessons from the first year around the amount and level of health assistance people needed. It was a lot. And secondly, we tried to let the data and what our knowledge, the knowledge gained, help guide a little bit better the second year how we're actually doing these. I'm sure we'll learn a lot this year as well. So I'm not saying that we've, cracked the nut perfectly here, but we think we'll be a lot more solid this year and hopefully a lot more solid the following years as well.
I'd like to make a comment, yeah. And then I'll get to your question too. But as we work on the matrix, and I've heard you say a couple of times, and I'm glad to hear it, that you didn't have a sophisticated matrix for evaluating the outreach grants in the first year. And I just want to be careful that we don't box ourselves too much in a corner that, you know, that we equate the number of dollars spent on an outreach grant to the number of enrollees reached, because different populations are much more difficult to reach at times. And so I don't want to make it so simple that, you know, an outreach organization that got, you know, X dollars and found, you know, X number of people, that we just make it that simple. We need a much more sophisticated matrix to collect this information and figure out the best and highest use of limited resources to make sure that we get our outreach efforts targeted in each year to those populations that are still not stepping forward and not getting the assistance that they need to find the right place to be in our insurance marketplace. And so,
yeah, thank
Senator
you.
Sharon.
That's along the lines of what, you know, I think that when we just talk about this in terms of how many people were enrolled against the number of dollars we put out for trying to find them to get them enrolled, you really miss what we're building here. And we can't just measure it on that, because we have failed for years at being able to reach significant groups of people who are eligible for coverage. So they don't have coverage, and we have all the consequences of uncompensated care that go along with that. You're building a system along with this. These organizations that are not your traditional groups, that have their grant writers, that have all of their technologies in place, these are churches. These are new immigrant groups that are the trusted voices in their community, and they might just be at the barber shop down on the corner. And what we're building with these dollars is just not enrollees, but systems to reach to these groups of people that we have not been able to reach before. And there's a high value in that that's not going to be measured in the short term. It's a long-term investment at finally reaching these groups of diverse populations that we are not having good health outcomes in. So I think that it would be very short-sighted to have such a narrow, not that it can't be one of the criteria we'll look at, but it would certainly understate what the value is of these grants. If we are targeting them to the person who cuts somebody's hair that they go to, because no traditional Western haircut person knows how to cut that hair, and that's the person they go to, and that's where they talk, and that's where they can get some information. We simply have to break out of our old style of networking, and I'm hoping that that's happening with these grants. And then I just have a couple of other questions, and that is, I think this relationship with the navigators and the brokers is critically important. I got many, many calls, which I sent diligently to you and others, from navigators and brokers, of frustration of being able to be trained properly, timely way, be included on lists. When you're doing this outreach, it's that you have lists in the various regions of the state for people to know who are the navigators, who are the people that we can access, and who are our trusted voices in our community. Getting that to the state fairs that you're going to, or wherever you're going, that people have the lists from that particular, not a 70-page list of the state's navigators, but if you're going to Blue Earth County, which is where I am, or Nicola County, that at that fair they have a list of the brokers and navigators in that region, that kind of activity, and that there's better access. I heard you say you're hiring a couple people. I don't know if that's enough. I mean, it doesn't seem like enough during the enrollment period to be able to not have those professional people sitting on the phone waiting to talk to somebody. I just don't like to see us have that be repeated. And so that's just a comment there that I really will be watching for the kinds of complaints. I think it's a measure of what's happening in my office. And then my final question, if I may continue, is it's unclear to me if there aren't some things that we can remove completely, not require people to do during the next round because they just bog down the system. For example, is it absolutely necessary that everybody has to renew or do some kind of paperwork or some interaction in the system if nothing's changed? I mean, why do we have to, for a year, clog the system up with simple renewal on something that is unchanged? And it just seems we ought to be focusing our energies on if there's a change of status, or if there's a change of income, or if there's a change of employment, or you want to drop somebody because the family member's got their own situation going on. You know, I can see where that has to happen. But there's loads of people who just renew the same thing year after year after year. And why would we clog up our entire system with that same group of people?
Mr. Lyons.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, and we agree with you on that point. And the guidance that we hit, so there's this issue of renewals, right? And it happens for both public insurance programs and those enrolled in the private market. And those of us who are in job-based coverage know that, like, if you're enrolled through the state employee plan, if you don't have a change, you don't have a change, and you just continue on in your current, and they just auto-renew you, essentially, into your current coverage, which I think is the situation you're describing.
Yeah, if I don't do something active,
right. And we're actually intending to mimic that for the renewal period. People certainly will have the ability, if they're currently covered and they want to make a change, to actively go in and make that change if they want to do that, meaning shop around, see if the policy that they have is currently the one that they want to stick with, or if they want to make a change, actively do that. If they choose not to do that, we will auto-renew them into the policy that they're in. And so, and we'll be getting some guidance out to, getting a letter with that information out to all of our enrollees currently. That'll be coming in the coming months, or coming weeks, I should say, or into the fall. So I think very much what you described is what our intention is to auto-renew people who don't want to make a change, who simply are happy with what they have, don't want to, you know, go through the hassle of going back on the site and trying to find a different policy. If they're happy with what they have, we'll simply auto-renew them into what they currently have.
Wouldn't you need federal approval for how you're going to approach the renewals? Isn't there guidance coming out on how you need to approach those issues?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The original guidance that came out from the federal government was quite onerous, I would say, in terms of how the renewal process needed to work. I think they received some fairly strong feedback, both from their own people at the federal government as well as from the states saying, you got to give us more flexibility around this. And the second guide is, to their credit, did give a lot of flexibility for states around how they do this. We are following that sort of second guidance. We have submitted a plan to the federal government as of last Thursday, I believe, to sort of encompass what I just described, Senator, which is that people have the ability to come in and shop, but they don't need to do that if they simply don't want to make a change. And we're awaiting feedback from the federal government on that. Mr. Chair, if I could just go back for very briefly to the issue of the navigator and broker question that you had, Senator Sharon. I want to make it clear, we have certainly more than two people working on these issues. We've hired two sort of point people so that at a high level, if either navigators or brokers so they always know they have one specific person they can talk to if all else fails. We certainly hope that all else doesn't fail. And they also hope to coordinate our overall efforts. So we have, for example, 800 numbers now in our latest round of RFPs so that brokers will have their own number, navigators will have their own number. It won't be fed into the general number of MNSHA. We'll have dedicated staff that will be working to answer their phone calls. Part of the frustration that brokers had, that navigators had in the fall, is that they, in a sense, were in the same queue as everyone else. So they'd call up trying to work with a client, trying to help a client, and have to wait, you know, an hour and a half to get a question answered. And sometimes they couldn't get that question answered because it gets to the second point that you raise, which is that because I think of the accelerated timeline towards the lead up towards the October launch of this thing, there was not as much attention paid to the training of individuals and getting them the right information in the field, whether that's brokers and agents, navigators, or certified application assisters. We're taking a very concerted effort this summer and fall to make sure that we get that training done and that it's available to individuals and also posted online and in all the ways that people have come to expect that information to have. So I think we're, again, trying to learn lessons from what didn't go well in the fall and to make a lot of those improvements moving into this fall as well.
Well, we've got several more questions and still quite a bit of agenda to get through. Representative Mac?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief just on the navigator issue. Moving forward, I understand that we are reaching difficult-to-reach populations and the challenges there, but I do think that in looking at the past year, what you could learn is that there were some organizations, and I'll just go to bat for my own county, the only county that got a navigator grant, Dakota County. I think that there are models out there that really did work in terms of making those dollars go very far and using community partners. I think that in contrast, there were certainly some folks that got the grants that came up really, really short. And I think were a huge disappointment for the amount of money that they were given. And it's inexcusable in my mind. And so I just think that while, yes, to your point, Mr. Chair, there are challenges, and money doesn't equate to people enrolled necessarily. I do think it's fair to say that for the taxpayers and the folks that are investing in this, that you can have expectations, you can have benchmarks, and you can set that out there, and you should be able to point to models that can be tailored. And I think we've seen that happen in other programs. I think that certainly can be here, and we shouldn't approach it as if we're constantly having to recreate the wheel and kind of allow for excuses for, this is really challenging because of this. This is really challenging because of that. I think we all understand that, but you still, for the amount of money that some of these folks are getting, they should have a track record. They should be accountable for the money, and they should show results, and if not, certainly not be given a second chance, in my mind, because there are models that work, and that should be rewarded and then maybe even pointed to for other folks to look at. If you want the grant, here's something that's working. Figure out a way to tailor that in your part of the state for the population you're trying to reach. So I guess that's just a thought. And then one just question, just to follow up. If I heard you correctly, Mr. Lights, did you say that the intention of Minsure is to allow for an auto-renewal process? I'm skipping topics, but I just wanted to follow up and make sure I heard that correctly, that that's the intention you're waiting to hear from the federal government on the allowance of that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, that is correct.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, Representative Mack, because I think you raise a very good point around sort of the navigator portion of this and the importance of encouraging spread of models that work and discouraging spread of models that don't work, quite honestly. I think one of the things that I failed to mention to Senator Sharon's earlier question is that in addition to bringing on the liaisons that we have with the navigator community and the broker community, we're also going to be creating what we're calling stakeholder forums, which is really our intent to try to engage both the broker agent community as well as the navigator community in more holistic ways around policy issues, but also to create forums for the sharing of best practices, because I really think that you make an absolutely critical point that organizations know what they know, but they don't always know what's working for other people, and they want to succeed, so they're generally pretty open to hearing about that stuff. And part of our role is to try to create those forums for them to be able to share that information. That's something very actively we're starting, frankly, this, I guess, in the month of August to do, so that we're ramping that up towards. So I appreciate the question. You're absolutely right.
We have Representative Loeffler next, and then I'd like to, if possible, move on to the next segment for the U of M and SHADAC findings, but if we have to keep going, we can.
Thank you,
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, and I share your desire to get to the other important parts of the community. But as we're on outreach, I did want to say that I thought it was appropriate the first year that we really focused on individual outreach because of the individual mandate and the general structure of the program. But it felt like left behind was the small business outreach. And that's a really critical part of our economy. And they have both there are advantages to both the employee and the employer to have group policies. And I don't feel like we've communicated that effectively or done outreach to them. And is that part of your outreach strategy in year two?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, yeah, I think you're correct in the sense that in thinking about where the priorities were placed year one, they really were focused on the individual. And I think as a result, we didn't see, I think it's fair to say, very robust enrollment in the small employer market. It was much smaller than I think had been anticipated and much smaller than frankly, every state sort of faced this, that the enrollment wasn't very high. We're taking a look at that and sort of doing some evaluation around the, as we think about priorities into the future. We obviously want to, you know, have the opportunity still available for small employers to enroll. I think we're taking a look now at in the list of priorities and the list of things that need to sort of be there for follow-up and enrollment, how the small employer portion of this fits in. It's something that we no longer term as a very important aspect of this. I think it's a matter for us of sort of sorting through the priorities in the short run, ensuring that we get that as robust as we possibly can, and then sort of move through things. So we know it's an important issue moving forward. I don't know that it's one that we're going to be focusing heavily on for the fall, but I think it's one that we anticipate will be one that, as we move forward, will be something that we'll need to look at more robust in a more aggressive way.
Mr. Chair, I just say I'm disappointed in that, just because I do think there are very clear advantages to both the employees and the employers to do it as a approach it as a group process, and I think we've missed a real opportunity to meet a lot of people who are uninsured, who are disproportionately working for small employers, and that is a trusted resource and an effective way to do outreach. The other thing I would just note, that if we're going to go towards an approach on a passive renewal of some sort, that we really have to be careful on the marketing on that, because for medical assistance in Minnesota Care, there are federal requirements for recertifying eligibility, providing all the, you know, the data that we need to earn the federal reimbursement, which we value. And we don't want people making choices without us understanding that for the majority of Minnesota Minsure enrollees, they are actually not going to be able to participate in quite the same way in whatever you would design as a passive enrollment.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler, that's well understood, and I know DHS is working on their sort of renewal plan as well in terms of how they're planning to do that. That would be, I think, addressing the very concerns that you're talking about. And I should have qualified my remarks when I said about auto enrollment or passive enrollment to really be referring to the qualified health plan side of the world, not as much on the Medicaid and Minnesota Care side.
Thank you. And then my last comment would just be to Representative Hoppe's continuing quest. That one of the things that we do have to remember, and Chair Huntley's calculations, one of the things we have to remember is that MCHA, our high-risk pool, has been basically phased out in favor of people going into this, because now there's no longer market discrimination based on pre-existing conditions. So I know I've heard from a lot of former MCHA members who would be considered insured, who are just thrilled at the money that they're saving now that they're no longer paying that penalty. And so when we evaluate who's insured and did they have insurance before, I think we need to look at how many of those were the people we personally had stepped up with a high-risk pool for.
Well, and not only did the individuals pay up to 25% more, I think, 20 or 25% above market rates to get into the MCHA plans, there was also the assessment on employers. That we should be able to phase out, and we're intending to. So,
just a final comment on that. You're just in lots of different ways making my point, which is there's more measures here than simply some association between enrollment and grant dollars. There's just so many other achievements occurring here, and future potential achievements if we design more systems that have better outreach to groups that have been untouched in the past, that we've struggled for years. I've been here. Every year we talked about how to get these uninsured people who could be covered into the program. So,
Senator Benson, last word.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, with briefly, and Mr. Lights, no comment is needed, but on the outreach grants, I checked the 990s of some of the outreach grantees and noticed an increase in executive director salaries concomitant with the issuance of the grants, so I think we need to be cautious about who we're doing business with. But back to the auto enrollment, you mentioned it's for qualified health plans, and you mentioned federal input. What other stakeholders were at the table as you were designing the program that you sent to Washington for approval?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the plan that we submitted was one that we've worked very closely with the health plans on, so it's been one that we've worked. They'll be the ones who are likely most heavily affected. It's also a plan that we've shared with some of the key stakeholder groups that represent sort of the consumer side of this to ensure that they've also had input into that process.
Because, Mr. Chair, I just wanted
Senator
to make
Benson.
Sure brokers renew people all the time. They probably have some really good ideas. I know health plans renew people all the time, and all I heard was federal government. One of the reasons we're in this sort of sticky mess is because there wasn't adequate stakeholder input in the development of this process, so I would ask you for auto renewal. For example, the broker portal. We've heard mention of it. We don't know when it's ready. If a broker enrolled someone and that person's being auto-renewed, does the broker remain the broker of record so that they can continue to service and support that client? We're moving into developing a process, and I don't want us to be repeating mistakes by leaving people away from the table. Guidance from Washington is fine, but they don't ever have to clean up the mess.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, no, they don't. And I mentioned guidance merely because we have to sort of work within that framework. What I can assure you is the following. We made a strong commitment, and I think it's a very real commitment, to ensure that as we've made any major policy changes within MNsure in terms of establishing what our policies are going to be, that we've sought broad stakeholder input. With regards to, I'll give you an example. We're meeting a little bit later this afternoon with the brokers and agents and Deloitte to ensure that there's a continuing feedback loop that's occurring between the work that we're doing, the prioritization that we're doing around that work that Deloitte's doing, and we're doing that with all the stakeholders, not just the brokers and agents. We're doing it with the plans, with the navigators as well. Your point's very well taken, and I absolutely couldn't agree more. I think that that was part of the challenge that we had in the fall. We're working to make that a lot better. It's probably not perfect yet, but I think it's better than it was, and we're committed to continuing to improve it.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll move on to agenda item number 5. I'm not sure if it's really numbered 5 anymore as we've been moving along here, but update on the most recent enrollment figures. We'll invite Julie Sonier and Dr. Lynn Blewett. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record. And
Lynn Blewett.
I'm Julie Sonier.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Lori and the committee members. We're really pleased to be here today. I'm the director of SHADAC and a faculty member in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota in the Division of Health Policy and Management. And SHADAC is the State Health Access Data Assistance Center. We've been around almost 15 years. We do work on conducting health policy analysis. We translate research to policy, and we try to leverage state and federal data resources to inform state health policy. So this project was conducted, was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who funds it's the state network project. They are working with 11 states to implement health reform across the country. Minnesota is one of those 11 states. So this project is funded as part of that project, which is we're one of the technical assistance providers. We provide data and information to the states who request that, mostly around outreach enrollment, but also evaluation of health reform and how to use different measures and metrics to evaluate the implementation. So Julie Sonier took the lead on this study. She's came from the state of Minnesota in the health economics program, was the state health economist. We were really happy to have her continuing in health policy. She's very knowledgeable about the markets, and she's going to do the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here today to talk about the report that SHADAC published in June on some of the early impacts of the Affordable Care Act on health insurance coverage in Minnesota. And I'll be talking from a handout, which is a PowerPoint slides. Thank you. First I wanted to talk about why we did this study. Obviously, there is great interest among policymakers in understanding the ACA's impacts in as timely a way as possible. And one of the things that we know and are frustrated by, as are many people in this room, is that state-level information on health insurance coverage, although it's available from a variety of sources, mainly from surveys, detailed 2014 estimates from those surveys in general won't be available until the fall of 2015. And so meanwhile, though, we know that the Affordable Care Act's coverage provisions are having an impact on who gets health insurance coverage and where they get it from. And we've got some pieces of information about what's happening, and some of those pieces are readily available in Minnesota, such as, for example, the number of people who have enrolled in coverage through MNsure. But that only tells part of the story, and really what our goal was to take a step back and take a look at that bigger picture and really understand what's going on. There's been some national level information that's coming out from polls and surveys on some of the changes nationally in the uninsurance rate. But we know that there are many reasons why the ACA's impacts are going to vary by state. So, for example, states have made very different policy decisions about whether to expand Medicaid coverage, whether to run their own health insurance exchanges. And also we know that states are in very different situations in terms of the size of their uninsured populations to start with and other economic characteristics. So for this reason, it makes a lot of sense to try to get a more timely state-level understanding of the ACA's impacts. The next slide, which is number 3, I think, provides a little bit more detail on the data sources that are usually used to estimate the number of uninsured and some information on the timing of when the data will be available to describe the ACA's impacts on health insurance coverage. The first one that's listed is the Minnesota Health Access Survey. This is conducted jointly by the Minnesota Department of Health and SHADAC every 2 years. This is a large survey of Minnesota households that is done specifically to monitor trends in health insurance coverage and access to care. So this survey was carried out most recently between mid-August and mid-November of 2013, and the results were released in February of this year. So that's the source of the starting point that we used in our study for the uninsured estimate of 8.2% of the state's population. The next round of that survey, though, will begin in the summer of 2015 with results available in early 2016, so quite some time away. There are several other federal data sources that can be used to look at state-level coverage trends, and those are also listed in this slide. I think the key point to take away here is that we don't even have estimates for 2013 yet from some of these data sources, and 2014 won't be available until next summer at the earliest. And so for purposes of understanding the ACA's impact and having good information for making policy changes, this is a long time away. And so it's understandable that people are interested in finding more timely ways of understanding what's going on, which is where the SHADAC study comes in. The fourth slide in the presentation is sort of our attempt at a graphical representation of the entirety of the health insurance market in Minnesota. What we're trying to illustrate here is that there are many avenues through which Minnesotans get their health insurance coverage. At the top left-hand corner of that chart is group health insurance coverage. Most people in the state, about 56% at the starting point of our study, get their coverage through an employment-related group. There's a few different kinds of employment-related coverage, which I can talk about later if there are specific questions on that. But the bottom left corner of the chart is the second most common type of coverage, which is public insurance coverage. So these programs covered about 30% of the state's population at the beginning of our study period, and it includes state-administered programs, so Medicaid and MinnesotaCare, as well as Medicare, which covers the elderly and the disabled. The upper right-hand corner of the chart looks at various ways of buying private non-group insurance coverage. So that includes coverage that's purchased directly from a health plan, coverage purchased through a high-risk pool, or the two high-risk pools are being phased out at this point, or beginning in 2014, coverage that is purchased through MinSure. So at the beginning of our study period, about 5% of Minnesotans had private non-group coverage. And then finally, the bottom right-hand corner of the chart represents the uninsured, who comprise, as I noted earlier, an estimated 8.2% of state population at the start of our study. So instead of the partial picture that's available from the piecemeal information that we're able to get on various segments of the healthcare marketplace, the goal of our study really was to provide a complete picture of how health insurance coverage has shifted in Minnesota. So it's not enough to know how many people who have signed up for a particular type of coverage, because we don't know which people who signed up for that coverage might have been previously uninsured and which people are simply shifting from a different type of coverage. So our goal was to provide a complete picture of the change in the number of uninsured people in Minnesota by accounting for all of the other shifts that have taken place in the marketplace since the fall of last year. So the next slide provides kind of the high-level view of our methodology for doing this. Really, in a nutshell, our approach to this analysis was to estimate health insurance coverage for the entire state population at two points in time. So those were September 30th, 2013, and May 1st of 2014. We chose these dates in order to provide a snapshot of coverage in the state immediately before MNsure's first enrollment period started and 1 month after the end of open enrollment in order to allow for processing of enrollments that had been started but not completed prior to the official end date of the open enrollment, which was March 31st. We used information on the gains and losses by type of coverage between these two dates to estimate the change in the number of Minnesotans who are uninsured. And then we also account for population growth that occurred during this time period, because if we didn't, we would overestimate the reduction in the number of uninsured. So the next slide provides a little bit more detail on how we actually did this. I wanted to note that this approach actually has been used to estimate coverage distribution in Minnesota since the early 1990s. When I first went to work for the Minnesota Department of Health in 1997, this was my job, so I know it well. But what we do is we begin with the total state population, and we use available data to count the number of people with each type of coverage, being very careful to avoid double counting. So, for example, we make sure that we exclude from Medicaid counts people who are also enrolled in Medicare. And then we sort of, you know, put together basically a big equation and solve for the unknowns. And in both of these time periods, we had only one thing that we didn't know. So we were able to have numbers for all of the coverage sources in September 2013, except for self-insured coverage. And that's because this type of coverage is not regulated by the state. And so it's we don't have a complete picture of that that's reported by the health plans. And so for that period, we estimated the number of self-insured basically as the total state population minus all of the other sources that we did have a good estimate for. And then for the May 1st, 2014 estimate, we were able to get information from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans on the growth in self-insured enrollment at their member plans that happened between September 30th and May 1st. And so we used that growth rate for the self-insured number and on the May 1st side of our equation, which left just one number that was uninsured, which was the one number that was unknown, and that was the number of uninsured people in the state. And so we calculated that by taking the total population minus all of the sources of coverage that we had otherwise accounted for. So slide number 7 provides some information on where we got the data for our analysis. And I won't go through the whole list piece by piece, but I did want to note that we did make some adjustments to the various pieces in order to ensure that our analysis was as accurate as possible and that it accounts for the entire marketplace. So, for example, the data that we had on the total state population and for Medicare enrollment were not current. And so we used information on historical growth rates to estimate both of those numbers as of September 30th and May 1st. The other main adjustment that we made was that we also knew that the data that we had on the private market health plans did not represent the entirety of the market, but we were able to estimate what portion of the market was represented and then scale up the numbers accordingly. And again, the reason for doing that is to make sure that our analysis is as complete and accurate as possible. So turning to the main study results, there's sort of a page in the handout that has a bigger table that's not one of the PowerPoint slides, and that's really the very detailed study results, which is for each of these sources of insurance coverage. What was the number of people covered in September? What was the number covered in May? And what was the difference? But I wanted to highlight just a few things as the main study results. The first of those is that the number of uninsured Minnesotans fell from 445,000 to a little bit over 264,000, which was a reduction of over 180,000 people during this time period. That corresponds to a reduction in the uninsurance rate from 8.2% of the population to 4.9%. Second major takeaway, I think, from the study is that most of the coverage gains occurred in the state public insurance program. So those increased by about 155,000 people on net. This wasn't particularly surprising to us since it's long been known from research conducted by the Minnesota Department of Health that a sizable percentage, about two-thirds of the uninsured, were eligible for public programs and yet not enrolled. And then the third major finding from the study is that private health insurance coverage also increased during this time period. So we saw a net gain of 30,000 in the number of people with private coverage. There was a gain of 36,000 in the number with non-group coverage, and that was balanced by a slight loss of 6,000 people who had group coverage. Slide number 9 just presents another way of summarizing the findings. So we're looking at the percent change in the number of people by type of coverage. And so the number on the far right-hand side of that chart shows that the estimated number of Minnesotans without health insurance coverage fell by nearly 41% between September 30th and May 1st. But there are a few other notable things from this chart as well. So one is the fact that private non-group coverage grew by 12.5%, which is a very rapid rate of growth compared to what we've ever seen in the past. Also that we saw an increase of over 20% in medical assistance and Minnesota care combined. Putting the findings in context, slide 10 shows basically the historical trend in the uninsurance rate in Minnesota. So the size of the decline in the uninsurance rate that we saw during the seven-month time period covered by our study is really unprecedented in Minnesota in terms of its size and its pace. This slide puts our estimated uninsurance rate of 4.8% in May 2014 into historical context using data from the Minnesota Health Access Survey that goes back to 2001. A little bit more context for the findings is that our findings are consistent with some of the national analysis of early ACA impacts. So I mentioned earlier some of the surveys and polls that are starting to come out with information on the change in the uninsurance rate nationally. This slide presents some of those early findings, which generally are ranging from about 3 percentage points to 5 percentage points decline in the number of uninsured. And for the most part, those studies are looking at non-elderly adults. So they're mostly looking at the population age 18 to 64, which is different from what we're looking at. We're looking at the entire population. But nonetheless, it gave us some comfort to know that the findings that we were finding were not out of whack with those studies. And then finally, we also looked at what happened in Massachusetts during the first year after they implemented their health reforms in 2007, and found that the results that we're seeing in Minnesota are quite similar to what was observed in Massachusetts, where they experienced a 45% decline in uninsurance. Again, this is just among adults, but in the first year after they implemented their reforms. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the common questions that we've been getting about our study since we released it. One is this question about, well, how do we know which people were previously uninsured or not? Or do we know that the people who enrolled through MNsure were previously uninsured? And the answer to that question, unfortunately, is no. We don't have information on changes in coverage that were experienced by specific individuals, and that's because we were working with very highly aggregated data for our study. So we got information with the help of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans on the total numbers of people enrolled in private coverage without having any information on the characteristics of those individuals. But I think it's important to note that, by using these aggregated enrollment counts at 2 points in times, we are able to answer that question of how many people gained coverage without having the information on which ones. So the information on which ones is kind of a research question that has yet to be answered, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the research that we have underway that will begin to help answering those. Another question that we've been getting from a number of sources is, well, what's going on with group coverage? So we did show that decline, a small decline of about 6,000 people in group coverage, and we don't have enough information yet to draw conclusions about exactly what's going on there. One possibility, we think, is that there's a shift from fully insured to self-insured group coverage. And so we saw some swings that were similar in magnitude. We had a 39,000 decline in fully insured coverage and I think a 33,000 increase in self-insured coverage. It seems suggestive, but I wouldn't conclude at this point that employers are shifting to self-insured coverage. We really need information at the employer level about the kinds of decisions that employers are making in response to the various incentives and provisions in the Act. So some of the other possibilities there are changes in employment at firms that offer coverage, changes in the employer decisions about whether to offer coverage or not, or changes in the employee decisions about whether to take that coverage when it's offered. We expect that some of the first state-level estimates to help answer that question about what's happening at employers will become available probably about a year from now, in summer of 2015, which again is a long time to wait. But that type of research is very difficult to do and very expensive, and so there's only a couple of organizations nationally that do it. Some of the questions that remain to be answered, so our findings do represent a timely but very high level look at the coverage impacts of the ACA in Minnesota, and there are many important questions that remain. So one of those is, well, now that the uninsured population has declined by so much, what do we know about the characteristics of who's left? So that's a very important question for future outreach efforts. How many people who enrolled in MNsure were previously uninsured is still a question we're unable to answer. Are the newly insured able to access care in a timely and appropriate way? And then that question about what's driving trends in employer coverage, along with many, many others. So we can add to that list, perhaps. But I wanted to talk a little bit about some additional research that SHADAC is doing in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Health to begin to answer some of these questions. And that is a small survey which will recontact some of the people who participated in the state's health insurance survey from last fall and ask them about what's happened since then, particularly targeting people who were uninsured at the time of that survey and people who were purchasing non-group coverage at the time of that survey, to find out, did the uninsured gain coverage, or why not? So what are some of the reasons that are motivating people to act in the ways that they do? What were some of their pathways to coverage? So did people use the navigators? Did they use the website? What kinds of assistance did they get in enrolling? And then what have been some of their changes in access to care and use of services since last fall? So that survey will be conducted in the summer and fall of this year, with results expected to be available in the late fall. I do want to note that that survey will not produce a statewide uninsurance rate that we can use to paint a comprehensive picture of the remaining uninsured population. There are other questions that it won't answer as well, but it will at least begin to help us fill in some of the gaps in our current knowledge. So slide number 16 is simply our acknowledgement. As Lynn mentioned, the funding source for this work was the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's State Health Reform Assistance Network. I wanted to acknowledge Elizabeth Lukanen as a co-author, along with Lynn, and especially to acknowledge the data contributors, because we had the idea for how we could assemble this picture of coverage, but we could not have done that without the help that we got from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans and its member plans, from MNsure, from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and from MCHA. So that's our overview of the study, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your work. I did have a handful of questions, I think three. Number one, and I just want to make sure, my understanding of the federal estimates that have been done to date is that they have been based on surveys. Gallup did one, others have done surveys. And don't take offense what I'm about to say here, but it looked to me like you essentially counted. I'm sure there's a more dramatic way to say that in statistical worlds and so forth, but am I catching it right? I mean, essentially it was survey in terms of what everybody else has done, and what you did was actually count bodies in terms of how many people got insurance. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, that's correct. We were using administrative data as opposed to, we did not go out and conduct a survey to do this analysis, in part because of the need for timely information.
And thank you for that.
Mr.
Chairman, hopefully there's other states that are doing the same sort of thing and following your example. I think, at least for hopefully speaking for everybody at the table, I feel much more comfortable using an actual count of people versus a survey of a small percentage of those people. My second question, can you see the chart here? It's actually slide 10 of your materials. And I just wanted to make sure that I heard correctly in your presentation that you're using the same, with respect to what you're showing on the chart there, you were using the same sort of methodology this year. You've got the last one there shows the 4.8%, which you represented was the lowest in state history. But this methodology isn't distinctly different in any fashion from the methodology that's been used in the past. It was essentially a count in the past as well. Is that accurate?
Ms. Sonia?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, actually the earlier estimates on that slide are survey estimates, and the final estimate, the number for 2014, is the number that we calculated using the 2013 survey as our starting point. So it would be accurate to say that we look forward to updating the time trend with new data from the next Minnesota Health Access Survey when it's available. But in the interim, that's our best estimate.
And so my next question, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Sonier, is what could I expect? And I'm going to make you very uncomfortable. But the next year, when we talk about 2015, and maybe the best ask is, or the best way to phrase the question, what happened in Massachusetts? You said Minnesota mirrored what happened in Massachusetts, significant drop in the number of uninsured as soon as their approach took place. What happened in year two is the real question.
Ms. Sonier?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, the largest portion of the decline in the uninsurance rate that Massachusetts has experienced since 2007 occurred in the first year. So I think it's important to provide some other context to what's going on there. So in Massachusetts, depending on the source of data that you use, I think it was anywhere like a 3.5 percentage point decline and up to 2008. And then in the 4 years since then, about 1 percentage point additionally. I wouldn't feel comfortable at this point saying that that's what Minnesota will experience, because if you think about it, sort of those years, 2008, 2009, I mean, were very bad economic years for the country. And so I think it's hard to project based on sort of that several years of experience exactly what Minnesota's experience would be.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Atkins.
This will be my final comment. And I'm sure that someone will share these comments with me if I'm wrong. But I would predict that you will see a significant drop in year two here in Minnesota as well. And I say that with somewhat of an educated guess, because frankly, the rollout of MnSure was kind of a stumbling effort that took place. And I don't think there's anybody around the table that would disagree with that statement. But it made it difficult for some folks to enroll. I don't think they had the same sort of challenge in Massachusetts. My hope would be that as things smooth out and it becomes easier for people to enroll and do eligibility determinations. And my understanding, I meant to ask this to Mr. Lights earlier, but I think now that we're up to about 99% that are making it through the eligibility determination without, and it was down like in the 70% range when MnSure got underway. Hopefully with some of those fixes, we'll see some additional people that are able to get insured. So as I said, I'm sure if that prediction is wrong, there will be countless people around the table that will make me eat those words. But I think it's actually going to continue to trend downwards. Thank you very much for your work.
Well, and a couple of things that jumped out at me, you know, as I read the executive summary and whatnot, and I know that this has been an issue. You started out with why we did it, and it's because it's been a matter of some concern. But what I'm just so happy that we have such a strong partner as the U of M and our strong Department of Health in having the history to be able to make these counts. And in your executive summary, you said that, to our knowledge, this report is the first assessment of early state-level impacts of the ACA on health insurance coverage. And I'm just really pleased that we're able to deliver on that, because these are really important questions that every state is struggling with, and we are able to get a jump on them with our existing really strong partnerships with you. So thanks for that. An additional comment about the fact that these are snapshots at the two points about 7 months apart from each other. And also, if we listen to Mr. Light's presentation, I'm not sure if he said it today, but he said it on NPR yesterday and has said it to me several times in offline meetings. I think we're still having about 1,000 enrollees per day since the May 1st snapshot, which was the result of this count. And so, I mean, things are still happening. And I think to Representative Atkins' point, you know, as we get better data analytics, I think that things are continuing to move in the right direction. And I'm very encouraged. We have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of issues yet to address. But I'm really glad that we have this initial insight. I'm looking forward to that report in the fall that'll fill in some of the gaps on you know, how people found access to coverage, who found access, how did they change, you know, but understand that it won't actually fill this chart in again. It won't be a new rate of uninsured, but we'll start filling some of these gaps and really gain a better understanding. And that's what we as policymakers need in order to make the right decisions and try to keep the state on the right course. Senator Sharon, you had a question?
Thank you. I think that you've spoken to it already, Senator Lori, but among the questions that you identify still need to be answered, one is the characteristics of the remaining uninsured population. Is there a plan in place to get an answer to that question? It really connects to the earlier discussion about how we target outreach grants and how we measure their outcomes. And so we're moving into a distribution of grants without really a full understanding of the remaining characteristics of the uninsured. So targeting of grants is better if we have that information. Do you have a sense of how and when and what the process will be to get us that information?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, some of the work that we're doing in this, what we're calling the recontact survey, will help with that. But as I said, it's not a complete picture of the uninsured population. We'll be contacting people who were uninsured last fall, but undoubtedly there are people who are uninsured today who were not uninsured last fall. And so I think it would be misleading to have to characterize that as something that will give us that comprehensive picture of the uninsured. Really, you need one of these big household surveys to really get information on the demographic characteristics, by which I mean, for the most part, things like income, age, where people live. We are, I would say, beginning to work with one of the other state network states on a strategy potentially to try to identify geographically at the county level where the remaining uninsured are by taking some estimates of the number of uninsured people by county and looking at the distribution by county of who signed up for Medicaid and who signed up for the exchange, potentially and that their intent is to use it to help target some of their outreach for the fall. So we're experimenting with that. We don't know if it will work yet, but if it works, we'd be happy to work with other states on that as well.
Any other questions? Representative Mack?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get a handle on, and it's a lot of data and a lot of information, and appreciate you delineating a lot of it. I'm just trying to get a handle on, and maybe it's in here and I'm just not seeing it as such, but what can you tell us what percent of the drop in the uninsured, what percent of that can be attributed to getting their insurance in the private market versus the public program?
Ms. Sonier?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, we can do that in a sort of a high-level way. So we know that the decline in uninsured was 180,000 people, 30,000 of whom sort of on net were people who gained private coverage. I'm sorry. So it's about one-sixth.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Mack?
Thank you for that. And I appreciate that. And you know, I guess the issue being, and that we keep going round and round about here on the Oversight Committee, the issue of the MNsure has done something for us in terms of getting more people on our public programs, many of which were eligible long before MNsure was or the ACA was ever even thought of. We just could never get a handle on how to get those people into the programs that Minnesota's had for decades. So, you know, I think that that's a key thing for the public to understand. MNsure did not necessarily usher in this miraculous ability for people to get insurance that never existed before. The individual mandate, you know, requiring people to have health insurance, some of those issues that happen at the federal level, kind of got us to this point. And which also leads into the issue of just the ongoing challenge that we'll have in terms of what that means for how the numbers work and the sustainability of MNsure with the public programs inflating at the you know, and that bill has to be footed by taxpayers and the QHPs. And so I just think that that's an important thing to just to keep in mind. We are accomplishing one goal of getting more and more people insured. That's certainly something that we all want to see happen for the sake of Minnesotans and our state going forward. But I do think it has to go in conjunction with the conversation of sustainability for what MNsure looks like, and really the fact that a lot of what we've seen happen has always existed for those folks. Those programs have been available. And so I just think that that's an important piece that we should be talking about also.
Yeah, it's true. And then I look at the slide that they put on the graphic here. I mean, putting the findings in context, and the first word in the second line there, unprecedented drop in uninsurance rates. I mean, you know, the package, the working together with all of the stakeholders, the navigators, the brokers, the provider community, the, DHS, MNsure working together, the carriers putting their best foot forward. I mean, as a package, we've made significantly more progress than we've ever been able to make in the past. I mean, and this has been a really intractable problem. I mean, these public programs have been there for individuals for a very long time. And these numbers are, you know, this method of counting, it goes back to 2001, I believe. And this is historic how much progress we've been able to make in just that 1 7-month period. And again, I mean, I don't mean to gloss over the fact that we have much more work to do. We have some real technical issues to work through, but I think that Minnesota, you know, together with the stakeholders, put together a package that has us on a good track if we can figure out how to fix that which ails and continue to move forward. Senator Sharon?
Yeah, I just want to make sure. I wasn't certain if Representative Mack was saying this, but absolutely the public programs are in place. We, of course, are receiving additional dollars for new enrollees from the federal government, so it does give some relief to our state budget. But what wasn't in place, even though the programs were there and the struggle that we had, was that people were eligible for the programs, but they weren't coming into the programs. We had all these uninsured, all these uncompensated care costs that we had to deal with in the system. And the federal exchange does not integrate the public programs, but by going to our own MNsure system, we could integrate the public programs, and that's where we began for the first time this drawing in and getting insured those who were eligible for those programs that exist before. That's a huge value that we have to recognize along with the other struggles that we're having with MNsure.
Representative Huntley and then Senator Benson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Sonia, do we have any idea of the new enrollees, particularly those going on to medical assistance that are adults without children that were not eligible previously, and the federal government is paying 100% of the cost of that?
Ms. Sonier, do you have insights into that aspect?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, not from the data that we had to do this study. So we were using just total enrollment counts in Medicaid, but that would be information that I would think may be available from the Department of Human Services.
Senator Benson and then Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to note that in the discussion, the longer version of the report, states that implemented the expansion of Medicaid saw a decline of 4 points.
Going to our provider.
The expansion of Medicaid alone could contribute up to 4 points decline in their uninsured rate. And so what we really have to analyze is the value that MNsure added. A lot of people did a lot of work, and the $150 million federal dollars doesn't even count the extra hours for brokers and the county people that is just being eaten and is never presented. And so while we are happy that more people have access to care, let's be careful about how much money we're spending and what we're costing, because that next margin is going to be tougher to get, and it's going to be more expensive to get. And so if we're going to go for 100%, let's be cautious, because this indicates that there was a 4 percentage point decline just from the expansion of Medicaid, even in those states that didn't have an exchange.
Senator Lori. To that point, Senator Lori.
Oh, Senator
I would
Sharon.
Just say, you can't talk about that number out of context. That if you're talking about a number related to the expenditure to achieve a reduction in uninsured, and you talk about that number as tax dollars being spent, we also then have to look at that number in the context of the dollars that we are now not having to spend on other costs that were in place when we had these people uninsured. So you can't just throw one side of the numbers out without showing it in context to where we are no longer having to spend tax dollars and cover uncompensated costs or the bankruptcies that people have because they don't have health insurance. So I'm happy to talk about some of the numbers, but hate talking about numbers that are not shown in relationship to the whole.
And I guess you're, Senator Benson, you're looking at the breakdown on page 6 of the larger report. Is that right, where you're seeing the...
On page 7 in the discussion.
Okay. Where you see the increase in medical assistance. One of the things that I would have to note about that is that that includes a rather substantial former Minnesota Care population that moved over to Medicaid.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, should have been
incorporated into that Medicaid insurance. So it's not in isolation. It's and they're not necessarily the uninsured that we reached. It's very difficult to segregate one of these lines out and treat it in isolation and act like that would have existed had we done nothing else.
Mr. Chair, I'm reading in the narrative discussion where it talks about the Urban Institute's Health Reform Monitoring Survey. Et cetera, the fourth paragraph, third paragraph on that page, states that implemented the law's expansion of Medicaid coverage saw a decline of 4 percentage points. So I want us to be cognizant of what is really impacting our decline in health insurance, in uninsured. The Medicaid expansion, I believe, is the most significant piece of that decline. And I just want to keep some perspective on that.
Okay. Fair point. Representative Huntley.
Just a comment on that, Mr. Chair and members. We all pay in our family policies, and our employers don't pay for those, by the way, we pay for them, about $1,000 a year in uncompensated care. And so it'll be interesting to see from the hospitals if there is a decrease in uncompensated care given this 4% decline. And the other thing I would say is that the early expansion of MA for adults without kids will bring into Minnesota over partly this year and the next 3 years, $4.6 billion of federal money.
Is that with a B?
With a B. All that money doesn't go into the state budget. Ultimately, it goes through the state budget, but it goes to our health care providers.
That's right.
And what are they going to do with that $4.6 billion? They're going to hire a lot more employees.
And we've got to work on the workforce later on today, right?
This afternoon.
Representative Huntley. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've been trying to be quiet since I'm not actually a member of the committee, but I just want to bring in another perspective as well, and that is, as important as it is to reduce the number of uninsured in the state, if this thing, MNsure, can finally get to where it should be, or I should say when it gets to where it should be in terms of its functionality and ease of use and all the kinks get worked out, there's another aspect of this that is a little different that's going to be very important, and that is taking away some of the pain of having to deal with health insurance, both on the public side for people who are enrolling and the counties who have to do a lot of the back office work, and on the private side. And it may just help private insurance kind of stay in the game by making people more willing to navigate that system. So that's kind of an unquantifiable piece of this that's really important if we can get it all working right. So that may be a bit more longer term because, you know, there are some growing pains, obviously, in this. Mm-hmm. But once it's really going, I think Minnesotans will really come to appreciate how much easier this thing is.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll kind of go in a different direction a little bit. On page 8 of the report, the third full paragraph down that starts with, because the analysis in this report, it goes on to say there are many important questions that we cannot yet answer. For example, what are the characteristics of people who gained and lost coverage? I'll come back to that in a second. But what caught my eye was the next line, how many people who purchased coverage through MNsure were previously uninsured? And that's the question I asked Mr. Leitz, and I always ask, and I think we have to know that, what that number is, before we ever know whether MNsure is a success in doing what we wanted to do. But as I'm reading the report, that's the first thing that, you know, I noticed, because that's something I'm always interested in. And then I reread the paragraph, and I went back and looked. What are the characteristics of people who gained and lost coverage? And I know that there are people who have coverage now because of MNsure that they were not able to get before. I know that there are people that move from different programs, from MA and Minnesota Care to into the exchange. Did you look at in your report, and if it was here, I missed it, but did you talk at all about people who lost coverage because they had policies that were canceled because they didn't meet some of the requirements of the Affordable Care Act, and then people that might have had a policy that was canceled and then went into the exchange?
Ms. Sonier?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, so the data that we're using, again, are highly aggregated, and so we don't know about individuals. And when we but what we mean by lost coverage is someone who moved from being insured to being uninsured. And so undoubtedly there are many people who switched their type of insurance coverage or switched their actual policy during this time period, including people whose non-group coverage policies weren't compliant with ACA and they had to find a new one. We don't have any data on that as part of our study. One other thing that I think is important to mention is that our study is not a study of the effectiveness of MNsure. It's a study of what has happened in Minnesota with the implementation of the ACA. And so we aren't making any judgments about I think in our view it is clear that much of the work that was done through MNsure, including the very extensive outreach efforts, is responsible for a lot of what has happened, but we weren't trying to attribute how much of the change was attributable to different parts of the Affordable Care Act.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And my guess is you don't have this data either, but you know, I have a lot of anecdotal information. I've heard from people that are thrilled with the Affordable Care Act. I've heard from people that are not so thrilled. My guess is that you probably don't have information about even anecdotally about people that weren't part of MNsure or the Affordable Care Act that are private insurance. And do you have and I don't want to put you on the spot, do you have an idea if we're looking at those people paying more money in the private market, paying for, you know, what in effect is going to be, you know, the costs associated with implementing MNsure?
Ms. Sonier?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, you're correct. We don't have any data that helps to answer that question.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, one last thing, and you know, I say it all the time to Mr. Leitz and bring it up, and I, you know, I just think it's interesting that we have it here in the report. We still don't know how many people who purchased coverage through MNsure previously didn't have insurance, and I hope we continue to work towards that, and if you do the next report, and I know we want to protect people's private data, but if there's any way we can come up with that number, I think that would be helpful for all of us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, thank you for doing the work and giving us your presentation. Next on the agenda, I believe, is the Department of Commerce and a discussion of the rate release schedule. I don't know how broadly it was distributed, but this morning the governor sent a letter to the entire LOC and CC leadership that answers many of the questions that we've had in the past. Apparently, we're, as a state, going to attempt to replicate the early release that was accomplished last year with the cooperation of the plans. And with that, we can hear from the Department of Commerce, probably get much more detail, entertain a few questions about it. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Vandehay. Restate your name for the record, Mr. Brickwoody, and we'll spell it right this time.
Mr. Chairman, I accept your apology from earlier. thank you for that. Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwoody from the Department of Commerce. I'm joined by our Deputy Commissioner for the Insurance Division, Tim Vandehay. Deputy Commissioner Vandehay is going to step through the handout that Mr. Kwapik is distributing to members. This is an infographic that's been on the department's website for over a year, but we thought it would be helpful to revisit at the chair's request for some more detailed information about how the process of the rate review in Minnesota works and what our role is in it. So I'll turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Vandehay, and then we'd be happy to answer any of your questions for members.
Chair, other members of the Legislative Oversight Committee, as Peter indicated, this is a graphic depiction of the effective rate review process that we do here in Minnesota. As you can tell from the top of the page, we start with health insurance companies that decide they want to compete in the state of Minnesota and provide major medical products. They will calculate rates as well as produce the policy forms and submit them to our office. This year, the process commenced with the last date was June 27th for the individual market and July 11th for the small group market. That's a month to a month and a half later than the process started last year. The second part of the process is the Commerce Department's actuarial unit and rate review unit look at the filing on behalf of the public interest to ensure clear, fair, and justifiable aspects of the filing. Things that they review in this unit is the type of insurance product, whether it's individual or small group. They review the summary of benefits and coverage included in the plan. This is a document that's provided to the policyholder so they can have a high-level overview of what the coverages and benefits are included in the plan. They review the actuarial memorandums that are produced with the filings. This is the from the opining actuary of the company, and it shows the company's rate selection in comparison to the actuarial assumptions and rate ranges that they have come up with. We look at the actuarial value to ensure that the values of bronze, silver, gold, and platinum are properly calculated and within the parameters of each metal level. We look at rating factors in the rating data, which goes over the area, the age, as well as the cost of benefits, the network, and whether an individual over the age of 18 smokes. And then we also look to determine whether the product is prepared for to be put on MNsure, whether it will be made available only in the private outside market. On the left of the depiction, you see, at that point, the department can make two decisions. One decision is to send an objection, which details questions and concerns related to the filing, and the company is required to amend their filing and provide responses to the questions and concerns that we have. This iterative process does take several times often, and so that is the process in which we communicate directly with the carriers about their rating assumptions. On the right side of the table, you'll see that once we've decided that the filing does comply with our law, it's clear, it's fair, and justified, it's approved to be sold in the marketplace. And at the bottom of the diagram, it talks about the effective date of the policy. And so once the policy is both approved and effective, that information is no longer non-public and can be released to the public. And with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions about the relevant process.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the going through the process. And it was nice to see the letter come from the governor. I think we all agree at the table that the earlier we can get the rates out and give people the more time to look at them, the better. Knowing what you just said about the process and the way that the Commerce Department works, are there things we can do to help, or do you think that this is doable, or we can get the where you can get the rates released to the public by October 1st or close to it?
Yeah.
Mr. Vandehay?
Chair, Representative Hoppe, I do believe that the process can be undertaken at this time. Obviously, we just received all the filings, and we are working at as fast a pace as we can. I do appreciate that the governor acknowledged in there that really it is important for this process to continue and to be completed, as that's the best process we know of to provide reasonable, cost-effective rates to our citizens. At this point in time, I believe that there is a reasonable expectation that we would have it ready for October 1st, and that we will certainly make all efforts to comply with that request.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you. In this process, when you're taking a look at the fairness for the rates, are you looking at geographical differences? And do you have the ability to negotiate or influence or require an expectation for fair rates on a geographic basis? And if there are geographical differences in rates of some significance, are you able to articulate and make public to us so we understand what's happening in various regions of the state, particularly the rural regions, to explain why rates might be excessively high there as opposed to the metro area?
Mr. Vandehey.
Chair, Senator Sharon, thank you for your question. Yes, we are. As part of the process, we do look at the factors used to determine geographic differences around the state. And we have the ability to talk to them about those assumptions. I would note that it's really an evaluation of the underlying actuarial assumptions for reasonableness. I know that the term negotiate has been the way you used it. I would suggest that it's more of an evaluation of the actuarial underlying assumptions there. Part of that is the geographic differences within the state. And I think that plans, continue to try to provide products this year, and we'll see additional new products for those areas as well.
And then the Department of Health has a role in some of the geographic analysis as well, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
In terms of network adequacy and whatnot.
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Health does do that, the review of the network, the adequacy of the network, as well as the geographic service territory review as well of the products.
Senator Sharon?
On that point, Senator Laurie, perhaps you can answer this or you could answer that. The Department of Health's role in that is determining adequacy, but what is that? And the definition of what is adequate can be, it does not mean the same access or the same kinds of resources. Usually it is if somebody's around in the region that can provide a certain kind of service, but it may take 60 minutes or 2 hours out of a person's day to access that. So, I don't know what adequacy means and how that plays into the how you can apply expectations of the provider in the provider network for especially hard to serve areas of the state.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, I think you pose a very good point. I think I would defer to the Department of Health to answer your question, as we do not take part in that portion of the review.
Probably would too, but it is set in statute. I think it's 30 minutes, 30 miles for primary care, 60 minutes, 60 miles for certain specialties. In general, that's a very short answer to a very complex question, but it is network adequacy is a minimum standard,
so we can change that.
That's set in statute, and we could change that. And we did, I believe, waive it for certain types of service in order to ensure competition in every region of the state last year. We had to waive one component of network adequacy for the city of Rochester that otherwise would have had no competition at all. I'm not sure exactly where that stayed. I mean, and this is not, we're not privy to these rate filings and the what happens in this process right now. But I would be amazed if the folks responsible for this weren't paying close attention to those issues and dismayed, frankly. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm glad to see that there's serious pursuing of how to get the plans and everybody to look at making information available early. I just would like to have some follow-up information about how this changes the time frame we were just discussing with Mr. Leitz about, you know, their anticipation of when people are going to be accessing the system and trying to get those rates and that information, because obviously that might bring the public into Minsure a lot in a higher volume, a lot earlier, and we'd want to make sure that they have a good experience whenever that's released.
Then Representative Atkins?
I have 2 points, Mr. VandeHay. One is just an assurance that I want from you, and the second is a kind of a logistical or mechanical question. The assurance, 4 months ago, I think I first commented about I'd like to see an early release of the rates. The one caveat was that I wanted to make sure that you guys had all the time you needed to do the actuarial and other reviews and the ability to press hard on the plans to approve rates that were reasonable. Are you giving me your assurance from the testimony that you gave earlier that you have, if we're aiming for that October 1 release date, that you have all the time to adequately do the due diligence and negotiations that normally takes place?
Mr. VandeHay.
Chair, Representative Atkins, I do believe that we have enough time to complete the process in that time, or I wouldn't have shown concern and objected to the possibility.
Mr. Chair and Mr. VandeHay.
Representative Atkins.
I appreciate that. That was the one piece, though, that did make me nervous, because it is, you know, people, as we talk about, well, let's just release the rates early. Sounds so simple, right? But I don't think they have an appreciation for what you and your department do. It's not just a single rate that gets submitted. It's countless rates across countless types of plans from a number of entities that you have to go through individually, go through each and every one of those, and then go back and potentially negotiate with those folks in terms of what their rate actually is. It took several months last year, and we started earlier last year. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate your efforts very much, and I look forward to the early release. My question then, housekeeping or mechanical question, in terms of what you release, will it be what you released last year, the same summary fashion, so that we have an apples-to-apples comparison from last year's report to this year's report, so that we can actually see? I also want to be able to compare against Wisconsin, who's got 88% higher rates than we do. So if that could be a component in terms of where other states are at, I'd kind of like to know that as well.
You know, Mr. VandeHay comes from Wisconsin's Commerce.
Yeah,
so careful with that.
I actually knew that when I said it.
Mr. VandeHay.
Chair, Representative Atkins, I do believe that the format will be useful to use from last year with regards to the comparison to other states. I think we will also want to suggest some comparisons to an apples-to-apples comparison from the 2013 or 14 products to the 2015 products. And so we would probably have some concentration on that as well. But I expect that we would want to have strong comparisons of the other states as well as last year's products compared to this year.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, I would add to certainly the letter from the governor contemplates the Commerce Department and the Health Department working with health plans and making sure that the work is done, mm-hmm. Which is the most important thing for consumers, to make sure that the department has the time to, as you put it, adequately perform the rate review process, and that will ultimately drive the best possible products for consumers, but also to work with them in securing their sign off for releasing information, as was the process last year.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate Representative Atkins' comments. This certainly paints a picture of what the whole process looks like. And I don't think many of us, at least around this table, have taken for granted all that goes into the complications of making this work, and the health plans and the department and the back and forth. So I appreciate that. I appreciate the governor's letter. I appreciate that you guys are on a tight timeline. I certainly think it's a good idea today. Thought it was a good idea back in March and April when we were hoping to see this done and could have had a longer timeline like you guys had last year to get this done. And so I think that's a bit of a missed opportunity, but I am grateful and appreciate the work that you guys do and the demand that this puts on you and your staff to get this done for the people of Minnesota by October 1st. So, and Mr. Chair, I just had one other comment separate or question separate from the rate release issue. I know we're getting to a close and it's just a brief question. So whenever that's appropriate.
Okay. Any other questions of the Department of Commerce? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Berkowitz, so what's in the way of an October 1st release date? Actually, let me back up. When does MNsure need these rates in order to put them into the database and test them and make sure they're ready for public consumption?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I would defer to MNsure to answer that question. In terms of your initial question, what's in the way, I think as Deputy Commissioner VandeHay pointed out, we're just completing the intake of filings from carriers who are interested in selling products in Minnesota. That begins the rate review process, which Deputy Commissioner VandeHay walked us through. I think the most important thing, and as he as we talked about earlier in the governor's letter, is protecting that process, that process that we go through in order to make sure that products that are available to Minnesota consumers meet the statutory requirements, both federal and state requirements, and that they provide the best value possible to Minnesota consumers. So I think we are already at work. We will continue to be hard at work over the summer. And as Deputy Commissioner VandeHay said, we're going to make every effort to fulfill the request of the governor.
And Mr. Chair, if we could have Mr. Lights or someone from MNsure come up and let us know when MNsure needs the rates so that they can be tested and ready to go.
Mr. Lights, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, Scott Lights from MNsure. Senator Benson, the timing that's been talked about by October 1st having rate releases is a sufficient timeline for MNsure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we
Senator Benson.
Started making the request that they be released by early October, was early October still MNsure's timeline? Or was it November 14th? I'm just trying to understand what impact this has on MNsure operationally.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, obviously there was some lead time that's necessary to load the rates and be able to do the work that we've been doing. We've been working on a timeline in terms of doing that, that's similar to what has been discussed.
So October 1st was a reasonable expectation based on the operations of MNsure. And so it's not necessarily unanticipated that Commerce was going to have to deliver close to that timeline. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, my understanding last year, and I wasn't as closely involved in this, is that there was an agreement for the purposes of loading the rates into the system that we reached an agreement with the health plans to be able to allow us to do that. And I think that we were looking at a similar system this year for the purposes of merely the operational pieces of MNsure.
But the rates would have to be ready, Mr. Chair, was my point, that MNsure operationally needed the rates much earlier than November 14th, which means the review has to be completed and they have to be available, approved by the plans. And so basically all these processes had to be completed much earlier than November 14th or November 15th for operational purposes at MNsure. And so I think we're going to get the public information that MNsure would have had anyway. So.
Okay. Any other questions on this segment? We have another segment that we added. We're going to talk about the DHS is going to come forward and talk about the 16,000 pending cases and the 3,000 Minnesota Care that may have been calculated wrong, the premiums. And so we were going to give them that opportunity to come and talk about that. And we are trying to adjourn by 12:30. We missed that, but We'll get this presentation. We'll entertain your question, Representative Mack, and Mr. Morocco, Assistant Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. State your name again for the record, and help us understand these two issues at DHS and what we're doing to make sure that we don't continue to see these issues and that these particular populations are being addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Human Services. So there were two issues, as I understood, and so I'll provide just a brief overview on the approximately 3,000 premium, as well as the 16,000 pending the pending notices. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to the first point related to the premium notices, just for point of background, the agency sends out approximately 44,000 Minnesota Care premium notices every month. We became aware in April that there was a potential for errors within those premium calculations. We were also aware that there was some delay in the processing of the premiums, meaning that the time at which we would generate the premium notice file until they were actually going out was taking upwards of about 3 weeks. And so we had some concerns with those delays. When we became aware of the issue, obviously we engaged the vendors immediately and began to work to resolve those issues. Again, what we had discovered is that there were approximately 3,000 errors out of those 44,000, so roughly 7% of the invoices appeared to have some sort of inaccuracy. Mostly what we were finding was either some sort of doubling or halving of the premiums, and in some cases just some premium notices were not being generated at all when there should have been something there for the household. And again, we were seeing significant delays from the time that we were trying to generate the invoices until they actually went out. And so on June 9th, then, there was a letter that went out to all the recipients. Again, we were trying to address in that letter both the inaccuracy of the smaller portion, the subset, the 3,000, as well as just acknowledging that there are some delays that we were noticing. We wanted to make sure that there were two sort of, key points for these enrollees. The first being that there will be coverage regardless of what's on the premium. And the second was that there are some premium errors. And so it will still be the responsibility of the member, of the enrollee, to make sure that they pay those premiums, recognizing that there are going to be errors, and then providing some resource for those who suspect that their invoices were inaccurate to contact DHS. And so that was the intent of the letter. So that's sort of the history leading up to the letter. Where we're at today is that we would expect to see significant improvements on the invoices going out in August. We are currently down from 3 weeks processing down to 4 days processing. So the timeliness issue for the broader 44,000, I believe, has largely been addressed. Now we're focusing on the specifics related to the year. And again, we're hopeful that we're going to see significant improvements in the August run. So that would be for bills that are effective in September. They actually are produced and sent out in August. And then, of course, we'll continue to work with the vendors and with our key IT resources here at the State Minute to ensure that we have the kind of outcome that we're hoping for. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to the second point, this is related to the 16,000 pending notices. These are the notices requesting additional information for MA or for Medicaid. We became aware, and I think this is fairly well known, but again, just as a point of background, we became aware of the issue in June. We were receiving feedback from counties, and even internally, we were having suspicions that there were errors, but everything that we had access to seemed to indicate that those notices were going out. So despite the fact that there was approximately 4 to 5 months of pending notices building up, we were doing the best that we could to try to identify whether they were truly going out. And as I indicated, at least internally, it appeared that they were. When we'd look on the system, we would see that a notice was generated. I mean, we could see it. What we weren't aware of at the time is that the breakdown was really not so much specifically on the system side, but sort of the interaction between the system, the vendors, MinuteIT, and ultimately the manual process that occurs at DHS to actually get get those notices printed. And so during that period of time, we were also in contact with the counties. We were letting them know that despite the fact that we thought the notices were going out, we were suspicious that there may be some issues. We weren't seeing a decline in the number of pending notices go down. So we had been in contact with the counties, asking them to reach out to the enrollees or the potential enrollees, asking them to reach out and let them know that there is additional information that's needed in order for the application to be complete. Some counties did quite a bit of work around this area and actually cleared out most of the apps, even despite the fact that there was no notice going out. So that's sort of the history on it, where we're at now. All the notices have gone out and continue to go out then for any future pending notice. And, as is with MA, the coverage is retroactive. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's sort of the brief history on where things are at. I'm happy to be available for any questions.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So lessons learned from this. Obviously, you're working on improving processes. Have there been any ramifications for people not following through? The counties cleaned up the mess again. And frankly, they are working very, very hard and don't get enough credit, I think, for what they've had to do to make this work. I appreciate that you reached out to them and asked them to help, but process-wise, this is not acceptable. That somebody, the manual process broke down? How does that happen? That nobody checks, nobody follows up? So I'd like to know what lessons were learned and what decisions have been made to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Assistant Commissioner Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I would to your first point regarding the counties, I would agree. I think that they don't get the credit that they deserve. They've been tremendous partners for the agency and I think for the enrollees, that we're all trying to serve. To your second point, I would agree it is very unfortunate that these errors occurred. In terms of lessons learned, I think, as has been pointed out, particularly by Mr. Lights and others, is that there is a much stronger need for project management related to this. What we recognize is that there's a strong interaction between what is going on with the system and how that interacts between the agencies involved, Minsure, Minit, and DHS, and how we are assured that then the handoffs, whether that's handoff from agency to agency, whether that's a handoff from system to system, or whether that's a handoff from systems into a manual process, that there needs to be strong project management and oversight of those processes. So, I think one of the challenges that we had in discovering this is that there really is no baseline. So we don't really have a sort of norm under which we can then assess whether or not the numbers that we're seeing or the kind of activity that we're experiencing is normal. So when we see a certain level of pending applications staying relatively equal, again, we've never seen this number of enrollees before. We have not seen these types of enrollment processes or communications before. So one explanation could be that simply our communication was ineffective, that people were choosing not to enroll, that there were people who were simply just curious about what might be in the system and really didn't have an intention to enroll, to follow up with the additional documentation. Obviously, what we've learned since then is that that wasn't the case, that it was clearly an error. But again, when we go and look in the system, we would see that the applications that the notices were there. When we would talk to the vendor, they would say that they are going out. So, there isn't any one system or person or entity that's responsible here. But I think, again, the lesson learned is that we have to have much stronger project management that helps bridge those gaps between the systems and the agencies and the entities involved.
Representative Mack? Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, I just would like to wrap up. If a private entity sends a letter that says, we got your rates wrong and we mailed you notices after the due date, that private entity is punished by their customer. And you're sending letters like that to people who need help. and are afraid of losing their coverage. And it, people who are, you know, in stable households and have time to think through these things get sick to their stomach when they get a letter from the government. And so now we're taking people who are on MA in Minnesota Care and saying, yeah, we probably messed up. We think you have coverage. Just keep sending in the money. I mean, I don't think you understand. This isn't a project management issue. This is, you're not serving the people you're supposed to serve when you do this. And so there's, yes, project management can fix it, but a sense of urgency, a sense of responsibility. I hope it gets steeped in these organizations. There's been so many stumbles through Minsure's rollout. I hope that there's a cultural change that says, you know what, we're going to put the constituent citizen first and just move everything else out of the way to make sure that they don't get hurt in this process, because we just keep seeing it over and over again. Give us more money, we'll fix it. Give us more money, we'll fix it. It's got to stop. There's got to be a cultural change that says we're going to do this right for the citizens first. And I'm sorry you're having to get the brunt of this. It's just, I talked to the counties. They're having to build spreadsheets. They can't track everything that's outstanding by case. They literally have to build a spreadsheet that shows them what's outstanding and then go back and update it. It's not acceptable that we're putting people's data at risk like that, that we're asking county caseworkers to just deal with it. So let's get some things at the state fixed culturally, hopefully before we get too much deeper into this. Hopefully this summer is a time where everybody just buckles down and fixes it, because the counties can't take anymore.
Representative Mack and then Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be brief. And I think that the issue of some of the logistics on the public programs is a really big topic that I think should be covered and given some more time at the next LOC meeting. I had been hearing from constituents who had some issues with getting some of the letters with incorrect information up with regarding their premiums and things of that nature. And so I actually, just trying to get an understanding of the system, went to my county and just said, hey, can I come in and walk me through with a social worker what it looks like, boots on the ground. If I walk in, I want to sign up for Minsure. How does this whole thing work? And I did that a couple weeks ago and was there for about 3.5 hours. And it was an incredibly beneficial process. I would recommend any legislator to do it, because it really is very eye-opening to see, one, that the help that is there for people who need it, but then to see what our counties are dealing with. And I think the biggest takeaway for me in that was realizing the counties need a much, much bigger seat at the table. They need to be on the Minsure board. They need to be there. They could have headed off some of these problems, I have no doubt, because they were saying things like this last summer, some of these concerns that are continuing to perpetuate. And I think if they had a louder voice and could be at that table and head off some of those mistakes, that would have been very helpful. I think one of the issues that was eye-opening for me was not realizing that many of these social workers, they can't necessarily get to their caseload. They can't see these 16,000 pending notices at the county level. At the county, they can't get into the system to see where some of those mistakes are being made. Some of those pending notices happened, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, happened if somebody on their application was, they're supposed to spell out road, R-O-A-D, in their address. If they happened to do R-D as an abbreviation, it wouldn't notify them right then that they had to fix that, but it would get locked up in the system because that was an incorrect way to put in their address. At Dakota County, they have a whole whiteboard of instruction. Make sure you spell out these abbreviations. Make sure you don't spell out west, east, north, and south. Those have to be just the capital letter. Whatever it is, it's very complicated for the average citizen walking in trying to fill out their address. And from one small mistake, it gets locked down, and they're one of the 16,000. And then if they want to call their social worker, they can, but their social worker has very limited access to their caseload. The social worker who was doing the example for us, they have a task list of all the outstanding things for their entire caseload. The woman who I was working with or looking at, her task list of things that she had to be keeping an eye on and things she was waiting for to make sure applications go through, the task list was 6,800 items long on her task list, just one person, of which she only had limited access to see her entire task list because of what the system can handle. She could only see 500 tasks at a time. The rest are at the state level. If the item she needs to find isn't in that 500, she has to get a hold of the state somehow to see the rest of her tasks. I mean, it is mind-boggling what these county workers are dealing with, and it's no wonder our constituents are having as hard of a time as they are. And so, you know, there's a lot that could be said on this, which is why I think it would be a great thing to try to hash out and get a little bit more clear vision for the future from the department in terms of heading off some of this stuff. And certainly would be helpful to hear from the counties. I know that they have a lot of ideas, and I know that they do have a seat at the table. I don't mean to leave people with the impression that counties are left out in the dark, because they're not, and I know there are attempts at that communication, but it's not good enough. It's not, they don't have a strong enough presence in the back room conversation, strategy conversations, I mean, about how to make this better. And the people of Minnesota are hurting because of that. The very last thing I just want to ask, we've had some conference calls with the department. I wasn't able to be on the one this past Friday, but I know Representative Atkins was and Representative Liebling was. And I'd been on previous calls about this attempt to get many Minnesota Care, this first group of Minnesota Care folks and Medicaid onto Mincher, kind of that transfer. And we have a deadline coming up of July 31st. And my understanding is there's about 9,000 to 10,000 people that still need to get transferred onto Mincher by the 31st. My concern is, I understand if that doesn't happen, if the system isn't able to accommodate that in time, they'll have retroactive coverage, which is assuring. However, my concern is, because I've seen this happen in Dakota County, and it's part of the reason I went down to my county to understand, is people that thought they had coverage didn't have coverage. They've been having medical bills come, and while they do have retroactive coverage, the clinic doesn't necessarily care about that. They keep getting bills. Some have gone to collections agencies. Some are seeing their credit affected by that. And these are people on Minnesota Care that can't afford to have their credit report affected by anything. They're trying to get on their feet, get self-sufficient. And so I have a whole host of concerns about what's going to happen to those 9,000 to 10,000 people post July 31st. How quickly are their issues going to be taken care of? Because I'm nervous about a perpetuating problem of their bills keep coming. They're told they have coverage, and they will have retroactive coverage, but how soon is it going to be till that's there so that they're not getting collection agency bills for something that is really no fault of their own, but it's on the shoulders of the state to manage this problem. So,
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, so there was a few pieces in there. I think it would be a good idea to come to this committee and explain and outline what the county involvement is. You know, we do have, much as Minshew had talked about having specific liaisons for navigators and brokers, the agency at DHS, we do that specifically for, you know, for counties as well. So, we do have various conference calls, touch points, things like that. But I think it would be good to come in and outline that for this committee and would be happy and certainly open to suggestions that you might have on how we can better involve them. You know, to your point about, coverage versus non-coverage bills, I believe that is a significant issue, and that is something that we need to address. Certainly as we work, it's manageable to work on a case-by-case basis, but clearly, to your point, we need to find some way to get information to providers and to enrollees on a much broader scale, sort of how do we manage this issue, and that certainly is something we're looking at DHS. I just wanted to be clear on one point, and I think what you're referring to is the conversion. Those folks already have the coverage, so it isn't, for them, it's not a matter of, that they'll need retroactive coverage. They have coverage today. It's just that we need to find a way to, to get them to sort of renew through the new system, and so that's largely what we're doing now, and you know, much to the point of Senator Benson, you know, focusing on what are the lessons learned and what kind of steps are you going to implement. That's precisely what this first group is intending for us to be. You know, we will do our best to hold them harmless, but in the meantime, what we're learning is, you know, what does conversion look like for this smaller group of roughly 15,000? Because we know at some point we're going to have to convert upwards of 800,000. And so what we're learning is what are the communications that are proving effective? How many people are asking for manual applications? How many people are calling us on the phone? How many go directly to the system and have no issues? So there really are a lot of lessons learned that we're trying to derive from this current group and hopefully apply what works when we have to convert the 800,000 and, you know, change what's not working and trying to identify what really motivates the enrollees to take action. So I appreciate your comments. I certainly take them to heart. And similarly to Senator Benson, you know, I think her points are well taken as well. And we, you know, it is easy when you are talking about 800,000 people to look at it at more from a systems perspective and a project management perspective. But we do also obviously take those individual phone calls, and we know that there are folks that are impacted by this. So I do take your comments to heart. I understand where you're coming from, you know, and I think, you know, the agency would revert back exactly what you had said, that we do need to make sure that we are taking care of these enrollees, because in some cases we are putting them in difficult situations, and we recognize that.
Senator Sharon.
Yes, I agree with this, the comments that have been made, and I heard you talking about our making suggestions for improved relationship with the counties, but I really agree that the counties have had been handing lots of ideas for what they can do that would make this process be better for them, less of their resources being expended on this. And I just don't know how, if they're just deflected suggestions or if there is a real culture that allows for problem solving that includes those who are having to pick up the pieces. But my other point is in the errors that occurred now, where something was not that you could look on your computer and see that the letter was constructed but not distributed. Errors happen like that. But when you have one of that nature, whether that's a hospital or anybody, there has to be an analysis of the how does that system break down. Somebody wasn't watching, or somebody didn't see the next step. And all of that has to be articulated in a systems analysis. And redundancies have to be built into this system so that errors aren't made. If it's an error, if it's a person error, or if it's a system error, or nobody's assigned to a certain responsibility. In your comments, maybe you implied this as a project to be reviewed. But I didn't hear you say we're going to do a systems analysis, identify where the flaws were, and then build in a fix and then redundancies so that if it doesn't work the first time, that it's caught by a second and a third layer. We have to have that kind of effective management going on, or we will be constantly hearing people say, yeah, it's another problem, and we'll have to try to figure out how to fix it. It just is an exhausting response without us getting to what's the work plan, what's the deadlines, when will this be done, will there be redundancies built in so that we're not back in the same place again. That's just a comment.
Okay. We need to be wrapping up. Several of us have additional committee hearings yet. Representative Mack, was that your question that you had? We went over. Okay. Yep. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask about potentially meeting next month, and in light of the discussion we just had, if we meet next month, we could have the counties come in DHS and make sure that we're still making progress towards the October 1st goal.
I hadn't talked with Representative Adkins prior to the meeting about the next meeting yet, but do you have thoughts?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe and others, I'd suggest that you just share your thoughts with us in terms of when you'd. I think certainly we want to follow the rate release, perhaps even meet in conjunction with the release of the rates. So we've got it'll be about the hottest topic, I think, that we've got. In the meantime, we like Representative or Senator Lori said, We haven't really talked about setting the next meeting, so if you have suggestions on what we ought to cover as far as agenda items or when that ought to take place, we're also cognizant of people's summer schedules and that it's a little harder to get people together, but I appreciate the, I know both of us do, the turnout today. Thank you.
All right. Any other comments of members? Seeing none, we stand adjourned.